Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 436 of the Roguecast, recorded October 17th, 2023. Briefly, a non-corpse.
Welcome to the bitterly cold Texas.
You say bitterly cold. It's 70 degrees outside.
That's bitterly cold. We're barely surviving. We're wrapped in big fur blankets in here.
Heaters in every corner.
Burning all the comics.
Burning all the comics.
Just to stay alive.
Yep.
Just to hopefully get it up to 72 degrees. Warm us up.
I would be happy if this was just our normal weather.
Yes, I know. So many people would, and those people are wrong. All those people.
Randy, let me ask you, when you went out for lunch today...
It was very nice. Shut up.
Uh-huh.
No need for a light jacket at 50 degrees? A light jacket works?
I do not want to wear a light jacket ever.
Why? Light jackets are good.
No.
Do you feel it confines you? Is it like a straight jacket about you?
I don't... I like it to be nice where I can just step out in my usual clothes. That's all I want.
I like it to be nice where I can step out in a zoot suit. And
but that's a specific thing, Dave, and that's a little weird. And it is weird that you only wear zoot suits at specifically 59 degrees. Not 60, not 58, only 59.
Zoot suit riot. This is a week that... actually has a lot to discuss in it.
It does. Awesome. And there's some weird comics that we all wound up really enjoying.
Yes.
There's
one of which is both weird and disturbing.
There's one big
blockbuster. So that's going to be exciting to get to.
That people have been excited about. Then there's a lot of our favorites came out this week. There's a few of those. It's a good solid week for comics.
A couple of really good second issues as well.
We got a bunch of topics. We're right in the middle of spooky season, so we're talking about Mike Flanagan's new Netflix show, a Mike Flanagan movie, another movie that was like been a bit of buzzy that we all finally seen.
And there's trailers and things too. Even though there's not a ton of like Comic Cons and stuff that didn't just hit, but there's like a decent bit of news to talk about.
There was a Comic Con that did. It was called New York Comic Con.
It's true.
I don't count that one.
And as always, a bunch of random dumb jokes that only us will find funny.
I am going to mention a serious thing, which we may talk about more in a little bit, which is the passing of Keith Giffen.
Yeah, that's on the list.
But because he said something funny, and you mentioned New York Comic Con.
Yes.
Keith Giffen, famous for funny comics, among other things. I mean, also famous for co-creating, like, Lobo.
But just a wry sense of humor.
Wry sense of humor, for sure. Justice League International was his baby. And he, like, one of the last things, his last sentiments was he was sick, and he said, like, he's like, he didn't go to New York Comic Con, and he's like, anything to avoid New York Comic Con.
He had his family,
it was posthumously,
to post it
on his Facebook.
Yes.
I told them I was sick, anything to avoid going to New York Comic Con. And that was his last post.
Yes, and I think he concluded with a wahahaha, which was the Justice League International call sign.
Yep.
Do you know, I think this is apocryphal. I forget who it was. It wasn't like, it sounds like an Oscar Wilde thing. His apocryphal, I think, last words. It really does seem like something he would say. Either those curtains go or I do. That may be attributed to someone else, but it's a good one. And that's kind of what he did.
Yep.
And we'll talk more about that in a bit.
All right. So, new games this week. The big thing, again, another big release. The D&D Planescape. For those who like your multiversal Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah.
This is like Spelljammer, been out of print for... I don't think they never did it in 4th edition.
Right.
They never did it in 3rd edition, I don't think.
So
I think
3.5 was...
No, this is 2nd edition.
2nd edition.
This is like Spelljammer, has been gone for a long time, and just like Spelljammer, it's coming back as a big box set of 3 hardcovers.
The most talked about, at least, version is the video game that came out in the 90s.
Yep.
Which was supposed to have quite good writing. I actually don't know a lot about it. I assume it must have been set in and around, like, Sigil, the City of Doors
That's kind of the big thing of Planescape, Sigil, the City of Doors. It has connects to all their multiversal worlds and that kind of thing.
On the back of the box set, they have a turn of phrase that I like. They're like, in Sigil, like, they're like where... angels have tea with demons, and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Just quick to set the stage, this is the multiversal cosmopolitan city where you might run into any weird shit.
Run by the Lady of Pain.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah, wow, that's her name.
Sounds cool.
Yep. Anyway, I've only casually played a little bit of Planescape back in the day, so I don't have the nostalgic attachment to this I did to Spelljammer, which I also never played, but I had the box set and loved deeply.
Yeah.
So, but I'm still excited about this. The alt cover, which at this as of this list recording, we have one of.
Right.
Looks really cool, as is the regular cover.
If I'm not mistaken, it's like the other one, sort of the three-book set. One with kind of rules and character options and lore.
Yep.
And then one adventure.
And then a monster book.
And then a monster book, yeah. And it comes with, like, maybe a DM screen, too, I think.
Yep.
Yeah.
You're familiar with the Modrons? You know, those little weird...
Yeah, yeah. They're the multi-sided, almost as if dice had, like, arms and legs and intelligences.
Well, they put out... they're from the Plane of Order, I think, is one of the things. And they're like, some of the enforcers of this area. They're, like, the cops or whatever.
Yeah.
But, in the miniature set that WizKids is doing to support this, which I assume means in the Monster Manual, there is a slot machine Modron, which is pretty great.
That's pretty cool.
So I'm sure they did some fun. It looks like they did some fun stuff with this.
I believe the Modrons were in like the Fiend Folio or Monster Manual 2.
I think they were Monster Manual 2.
That sounds right. I was fascinated by them because I believe the simplest ones were like spheres,
yeah.
And then there was a four-sided ones, which are a little more complex, and the more planes you were that encompassed your form, the more sophisticated you were, and so the very highest level ones did look like biblical depictions of angels with like weird eyes and multifaceted structures and stuff, like you were complex polyhedrons, but the basic guards might be just like these little cubes and stuff like that, or walking around. And it was so weird, but it fascinated me that their kind of elaborate hierarchical structure. So just and that's just a little small part of it.
We sell those Modron minis all the time.
Yep.
People do like them.
Oh yeah.
Also, I feel like D&D missed a step by not doing like a new Fiend Folio and continuing with the Monster Manual. Pathfinder does Bestiary 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right.
There's something about Monster Manual 2, Monster Manual 3 that they don't do anymore. They stopped doing it with 3.5.
It's a little
second edition, but
yeah, those Pathfinder. You know, a guy sneezes over there, and they put out a new monster manual.
Yeah.
I'm not dissing; they're good.
It's surprising.
Well, I mean, D&D does other monster manuals, but there's column of things like Mordenkainen's Multiversal Monsters and all that kind of stuff. You know, and
I guess they want to differentiate themselves from the competition.
I guess I feel like Monster Manual 2 is a good name, but maybe that's because I was a kid and I got the awesome Monster Manual 2. And I just remember the cover art.
Yep.
All right, we got a board game called Globetrotting, which is from Asmodee, and this one looks interesting to me. It is you are trying to plan the perfect vacation around the world and accomplish your travel goals. So basically, you get a globe, has a built-in circular rule to measure the distance and cost of each flight. You're trying to accomplish the objectives on your bucket list cards, and you have shared travel buddy goals with each neighboring player. And you want to coordinate your travel buddy scores so you both get those, but you also have your secret bucket list goals.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, it sounds
like
fun.
That.
Yeah, it's a good concept. I don't know how the game is, but it sounds fun.
Yeah.
And the other thing we got is the Everdell Mistwood, which is Everdell's a popular sort of anthropomorphic animal resource management game. This looks like maybe a standalone solo and two-player version of it.
Okay.
Featuring the cunning and villainous Nightweave, who plans to take over Everdell with her spiderlings. But it also is an expansion you can add into the main game.
Oh, but it otherwise functions, you said, as a one or two player?
It seems to me like it's a one or two player game, yes.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah. That's it for games. There's, like, not a ton of stuff that's on our game list. Let's talk about comics for the week.
Okay.
Let's start with the blockbuster. Let's start with Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong, number one. People have been very much anticipating this. It is set in like sort of it's past continuity, right? Or it's not.
I think it's old history.
I believe it's just an like out of continuity.
Yeah,
This
would be in Elseworlds essentially,
right? And
they are centering it, and we can say this is in the first page.
Sure.
They're centering this around Clark Kent finally proposing to Lois.
Right. And the rest of the Justice League, which is pretty much a classic Big Seven Justice League.
Yeah, Green Lantern, Flash. Who else is in that list?
Hawkman.
Yeah, they don't show all necessarily,
okay. No.
but several of the big ones are in glimpse in there, Diana and all that stuff.
Yeah, Batman.
And they're like, we're going to cover for you, Clark. I know you've been burning the midnight oil trying to make sure things are kind of quiet in the world for this big thing, and we want it to come off. And juxtaposed against that is the appearance of Godzilla. Ultimately, the events of this are going to take place and presumably kind of interrupt his big moment. So that'll form the emotional framework of it. I have this feeling. I have a theory about it. I think that it's not just... I don't think the writer just wanted to throw it in there. I think something is going to come up that is going to threaten her and is in some way going to, like, she's going to get hurt or something like that, and he is. It is going to require him to, like, go to Skull Island or that Center of the Earth stuff from Godzilla to get something, and will require some alliance with them, with one of them.
We'll see.
Or it's going to be a, well, I need to go and get this thing in this deadly land, and it's tough to get through, and we need Kong's help, or we need Godzilla's help. I suspect it's going to set the stage for just some complications like that.
Or you never know. Kong might take Lois captive.
That would be great. That
would be good. Or maybe Godzilla would join the Justice League.
I mean, that's possible.
But
also incorporates a lot of the DC villains and and Skull Island.
That was the thing I was kind of happiest to see. Because, you know, there is, like, a little more character stuff and not a lot of monster fight stuff in this first one. So I was getting a little antsy a little ways into it, even though I do like the kind of old-school Justice League thing. But when, like, the Legion of Doom sort of showed up and started interacting with things, and things also got to Skull Island, which, if you've seen Kong of Skull Island, it has some cool, like, all its own predators and stuff there. In other words, stuff's dangerous enough that Kong, although he rules the island, they are dangerous to him.
Yes.
And you see some of those guys, and the Legion of Doom runs into them, and there's like, their subplot going on. Anyway, I enjoyed it, and I also liked watching, like, the machinations and arguments among the Legion. But it's fun.
DC also continues their sort of relaunch, pre-launch, whatever it is, of the Justice Society. This is there's a series of mini-series focusing on the... it's going to be... The previous one was The Sandman. They're going to do Green Lantern, Alan Scott.
Yep.
This one is Jay Garrick, The Flash.
Yep.
In which is...
And his sidekick, right?
They tie in with his daughter.
His daughter.
Who was introduced in the Geoff Johns one that had the all the missing sidekicks.
Right.
Basically, she had been erased from time, which is really interesting. Basically, Jay and Joan Garrick, who are now in their, like, 80s, discover that they had a daughter in the at the height of their marriage, and they've been made to forget her. Like, this goes back to a villain, a forgotten villain who basically erased her from time, and now it's, like, present day, and they're in, like, their 80s, and they're remembering their kid that they never had. So it's like these older people who have now a teenager.
Oh, interesting. They're a new teenager, Dawn Summers.
Yes.
She's called The Boom.
The Boom, which is kind of a weird name.
I guess like a Sonic Boom.
Yeah, it is. Right.
But anyway, it's an interesting first issue. I think they're doing some good work to sort of bring these characters back in. The sort of time-lost daughter thing is an interesting thing that ties in nicely with what Johns was doing, too.
So, you said the characters maybe, like, in their 80s. Now, historically, Jay Garrick has looked like he was, like, in his 50s, maybe.
Right, but these were World War II characters, so they're...
Well, they should be, like, dead.
In their hundreds, yeah.
But, like, sometimes, you know, they do that Infinity Formula type stuff, and they're like, they all kind of stopped rolling around their
50s. I think they all got stuck in Ragnarok. Canonically, I think that's still there, that they got stuck in Ragnarok.
And I assume that had been wiped out. That was like in the
80s. I don't know. There's some way in which they all lost time, essentially.
Right. It was a fairly handy invention so that you could just, no matter how much time span between World War II and now, they were always just, we were all fighting Ragnarok
for
like a limbo amount of time.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's still canon. I'm not sure.
Well, it's a handy thing if it is.
Yeah. We have a relaunch of She-Hulk with the Sensational She-Hulk number one. Still written by Rainbow Rowell, new artist, and very much in the vein. If you've been enjoying the She-Hulk run, you're going to be enjoying this one too.
I honestly liked this issue.
I really liked it too.
It was fun.
But it is a continuation, so it has the Jack of Hearts as her ongoing love interest, with some ups and downs there, and his power is still a bit of an issue. Definitely a kind of metaphor for a somewhat struggling relationship. But like, if his explosive powers were analogous to, like, say a personality issue of his, he's working on it.
Yeah, I
believe that's the symbolism there, is he's working on it.
Yeah.
And she's appreciative of it, and they are doing pretty good.
The height difference is real, though.
It is. Hey, listen, short dudes have historically been kind of looked down upon, and if this short dude can hook up with She-Hulk, then maybe we all have a shot.
So I have not been reading Rainbow Rowell's previous thing. I jumped in on this first issue, and I always like basically the surrounding stuff. Characters that have kind of, since Slott's run on She-Hulk, kind of found their way, like Awesome
Andy. She's got a former rival attorney who she works for, and it still does superhero-y type cases and stuff. The Mad Thinker's old robot, the Awesome Android, is still Awesome Andy, going back to Slott's run. And so she's got some, like tongue-in-cheek cases going on with some... Some deviance.
I loved that, actually.
The Marvel lore. And a continuation of an idea that was right out of the gate from her previous run, which is her kind of fight club. She and Titania ran into each other, and they got into a fight, and they kind of weren't... They were like, oh, that was actually kind of fun. Like, it was just good to blow off some steam, and neither of us got really hurt. And so it became a thing... And so the Fight Club is still going, and has a few other people in it, and it gets a little... there's, like, an awkwardness in this one.
Yeah. Thought it was really good. I like the characters that show up.
Yeah. There's one character, like... this was from the previous run, so it's not a big shock, but Volcana was from the Secret Wars. Yep. The original Secret Wars.
I haven't seen her in a while.
1984 and stuff. But, like, the Thing is in there and some other stuff. So, and then, again, there's some complications to it.
I just think the art is really nice.
I liked it.
Yeah.
I liked it.
We got short on this, so we only have a handful, but Marvel's Halloween special Crypt of Shadows is out this week. It's five stories by Al Ewing, Steve Orlando, Declan Shalvey, Sarah Gailey, Kevin Scott. And there's basically a sort of framing device where there's this creepy guy talking from the Crypt of Shadows, which is a mirror inside the Sanctum Sanctorum. And that character is basically like the Crypt Keeper. He gets a one page and he's introducing these stories. And then he has sort of a final thing. That's the Al Ewing story. He is either a new character or a character that's so obscure I've never heard of him. But he's an interesting new character.
Okay.
And then the stories involve, there's one that is a Scarlet Witch story by Steve Orlando. There is a, I think a Deadpool versus mummies, maybe, or vampires.
Okay.
There is a Daredevil story and Man-Thing, because, you know, Man Without Fear.
Yeah.
And then there's a Werewolf by Night story in there. Werewolf by Night and the Hulk.
What was the name you said?
Sarah Gailey.
Is it Gailey or Grayley?
Gailey. G-A-I-L-E-Y.
Okay. I just want to see if it was the lady who does those cat webcomics. Her name is close to that, but that's Sarah Gailey. Nope. Just checking.
Then there's IDW's book that I think we all were surprised and pleased with called Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees.
Yes.
I don't know how deep we want to delve into, like, the...
So I think
we can say what the premise is.
Okay. So basically, if y'all know Richard Scarry and Friendly Town, or what's it called?
Yeah, I don't know. He did a bunch of books that you might have read as a kid that had little happy animal characters in these kind of busy cityscapes.
Busy Town. It's called Busy Town.
Busy Town. There you go. And they were always, as a kid, this came out long before Waldo. This probably goes back to the 60s or 70s originally. But it's one of those things books that I think a lot of kids are fascinated with. The animals all look happy going through the streets and shopping and stuff like that.
Apple car.
It's a little like Norman Rockwell-esque.
Yeah, Norman Rockwell. Absolutely. Anthropomorphic animals.
Yeah. So, imagine taking that.
And then introducing one of the characters is a nice lady bear.
Who runs a hardware store?
And she occasionally just drifts off to the city, where she murders people.
Yes, if you're familiar with Dexter,
there
is a strong Dexter vibe to this, but it is also not Dexter.
It's something else.
In some ways, as I was reading this, precisely because they were intermixing what looks and really is a beautifully painted.
It's beautiful.
It's like watercolor art that's very elaborate, even reminiscent of a kind of a cuter Black Sad, the famous noir animal kind of detective comic from Europe. There's some disturbing stuff in
this. Have we ever seen anything else from Patrick Horvath, who is both writer and artist of this?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Because, man, can he draw.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's insane, the level of detail and the level of emotion that he gives these anthropomorphic animals.
It's very well edited. I guess I was going to say the storytelling is really strong. If this were a movie, I'd say nicely edited. There's a scene that I pointed out to both of y'all where she's driving. They've been showing this kind of idyllic opening in this rather quaint small town that she's in, where kind of everybody knows everybody and they do favors for each other. She's driving out of town and she's got a kind of a happy smile on her bare face, and she passes like the city limits or whatever sign. And then they show that sign, and then the next panel shows her face again, and her eyes kind of narrow, and her smile goes away, and it's like she's gone into predator mode. Mm-hmm. And this is a very sweet-looking bear. I mean, it is kind of like, you know, they did that dumb Winnie the Pooh horror movie, and it sucked, apparently. That's nobody cares about it other than its novelty, and that they accidentally showed it to some fourth graders. Oops. but this is, like, the good version of that. Like, actually disturbing, but also fascinating.
I would call this first issue great.
Yeah.
It is really good.
It was one of the big surprises for this week. I think we all really liked it.
I guess I would put it, it's reminiscent of Strays in the sense of taking something that making a smart kind of suspense horror story, not really horror, but dark suspense.
Yeah.
And framing it around a kid's property and yet not seeming like just complete, like, lurid trash. You know, like, it's actually well done.
Yeah. Then we've got another Dark Horse did their horror. A lot of horror comics this week. I think we're hitting that Halloween thing. Headless Horseman Annual. This is a anthology book. I don't recognize most of the names. David Dalsmalchian is the big name, who is, of course, the Baba Yaga guy from Ant-Man.
And he's doing a story with Tyler Crook, who...
Tyler Crook did the art. Yeah, that's nice.
From, what was his book? What's the book that he's known for? Colin Bunn? He did
Harrow County.
Harrow County, yeah.
A bunch of cool artists. It is a series of five different stories. If you've been digging like the Creepshow comic, looking for some anthology, that's probably a good one to check out.
So you should find that the Marvel anthology horror is sold out.
Right.
Then consider what's it called?
Headless Horseman Annual.
Headless Horseman Annual.
Did you
notice that the Dark Horse logo is a little skeletal horse instead of a regular horse?
And then Scout Comics did a one-shot called Bite-Sized Tale of Terror, which is all by a writer artist named John Clark. And this is, I think, four different stories. I read this, and they're all pretty good. It's got this sort of weird indie art-looking thing. They're good sort of Tales from the Crypt type one-shot. Okay. So if you're looking for a good horror anthology, several options this week.
Nice.
And then I want to mention subgenre number one. That is Matt Kint's new book. It is in
I should read that.
Not quite black label format, but it is oversized.
Yeah.
It's more like a magazine.
It's him and Wilfredo Torres.
Wilfredo Torres on art. The art is gorgeous.
Yeah.
And it is about a sort of a noir detective and a sort of cyberpunk future, except maybe it's not just about that. Matt Kent, if you know his stuff, likes to do weird high concept stuff. But it's a good first issue, and I'm curious to see where he's going with it. Looks like it is called subgenre. It does look like he's going to be doing some genre hopping between like fantasy and sci-fi and detective novels and that kind
of thing. I know he has previously done some meta-contextual stories, like stories within stories and things like that, and that is one of his playgrounds that he does.
And then, Dave, I believe you got the Watership Down graphic novel over there.
Yeah. This, you know, we've had... In the last, I would say, 10 years or so, a kind of a renaissance of graphic novel adaptations, Randy, of famous pieces of literature.
Yeah.
I mean, they're also adapting popular, like, say, YA books, like the, was it Rick Riordan?
Yeah.
And stuff like that. But you can find adaptations of, like, Kafka and Shakespeare and the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Didn't they do a Slaughterhouse-Five?
They did Kurt Vonnegut, yes.
Yeah.
And so this is a very, very beautifully put together adaptation of Watership Down that looks like it's the unexpurgated full book. It is a big graphic novel, so, you know, you're actually going to spend some time with it. It's not a little pared down version. I'm a big fan of the original movie, but even that edited out a lot of the book, and this does not. The art's good, and it has that sort of English watercolor look, I'd say.
I have never read this or seen the much-talked-about cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
I should visit it at some point, because it definitely looks good. It looks a little dark and sad, because I like animals.
Sure, it's going to be all of those things. But I would also say it is very beautifully heroic, and there's a lot of neat ideas in it. way he writes about sort of that's Richard Adams, the original author, mm-hmm. The rabbit, he creates a culture that is invented. Well, yeah, there's a language that's invented. I was going
to say, you were telling me about the invented language that sounded kind of, sounded interesting.
Yeah, it has like, and it wasn't just like casually done, as he wasn't like a Tolkien language maniac, right. But there was, the book had a glossary in the back of, you know, maybe like 20 or so words that would come up in it.
He was like Tolkien light.
Tolkien light, yeah. you know what, in some ways I would say he's a better storyteller though than Tolkien. Ooh. As far as, he doesn't have his predilection for maybe overemphasizing, you know, landscapes and stuff like that and the travels. But it is a big traveling quest book with dark turns for our questing rabbits.
And the opening of this is there's a cool map kind of focusing on a bunch of things. And
I think I might have told you, Nick, that the downs on which it is set, yes, this map is usually in the book. It is a real place in England, so if anybody ever wanted to, and I believe people do this, that you could make a pilgrimage there, and, you know, what is a few square miles for people, for rabbits, would be, like, the equivalent of, like, a 100-mile trek.
Yeah.
Because they don't do long runs.
No.
And so, yeah, it's pretty cool to imagine that you can really go to all the places in it. Anyway, this looks like I haven't read it, it's a big-ass book, but it looks like a very worthy adaptation.
Okay.
And then I just want to mention a few. I know number twos we had.
Green Lantern.
Green Lantern War Journal
was a really good second issue. That really
such
that.
A weird title. And let's remind people that's John Stewart's book. And the first book was good. It's you know, it was a rare to like get some sort of family life from him. He's like staying with his mom, who I believe is in a declining mental state. Maybe
yep.
Yeah.
And
Alzheimer's, honestly.
And the dialogue and stuff had a little bit of, you know, feeling of reality to mm-hmm. it too. I like the art in it. Now, I haven't read the second issue yet, but you guys liked it pretty well.
Yeah, I liked it better than the first one, to be honest.
Yeah, there's more villain stuff, but there's also a delving into sort of what Jon Stewart is doing in his life now that he is not necessarily a Green Lantern, that stuff is very interesting.
The second issue of Avengers Inc., the Wasp plus Victor Shade, who is not the Vision, in fact, the Vision shows up
right
in the second issue.
This is broadly a Wasp... Janet Van Dyne mystery comic.
Yep. Set in and around the Avengers Mansion that is now a tourist attraction.
Right. But also using kind of unusual villains that might be considered B or C list, but like are treated not as jokes, but as like interesting characters, arcs, and stories, and things like that.
This is one of my favorite new books. I actually really like this.
I thought the second issue was better for me. I liked this one better than the first, even though I liked the first.
There's also, there was a lot of second issues that got, like, War Journal was the same way for me. But
as a quick aside before we move on, Randy, I just wanted to mention, Vision shows up in it, and I was reminded how much I can like the Vision when he's well done.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was like, I would like for Al Ewing to kind of maybe repair his reputation and get him back as a mainstream character.
Agreed.
We'll see if it happens, but this is a good start.
Also, Tom King maligned him?
I might say so.
Well, I really like Leonard Kirk's art. I don't like this design for the Vision. Whoever did this costume...
It goes back a little bit.
I don't like it. The classic Vision costume is one you don't mess with unless you can improve on it, and they didn't.
I agree. I would say go back to the OG.
Also, the second issue of Hexagon Bridge, this kind of esoteric sci-fi book, is really, really good. I'm digging it quite.
That's an Image comic?
Yes, it is.
Second issue of Daredevil is another one of these that I didn't like the first issue very much, and the second issue kind of won me over.
Okay, I need to give it a shot.
They're doing a story where Matt is he is Father Murdoch now. He's not a lawyer. He's been brought back from the dead.
Is he a straight-up priest?
He is a straight-up priest.
He's Father Matt.
And so, the kids in the area like him, which fits.
Well, no, he's at an orphanage, which also kind of fits because he grew up without his dad.
Yeah.
He is like the cool priest who helps these kids, and these kids are all like juvenile delinquents. This opens with a cop showing up at the orphanage and like basically wanting to take in these kids, and he's having none of it. He's like, come back with a warrant. And it's great. And then they're doing the Daredevil stuff. So it's a different status quo. I wasn't sure about it in that first issue. It's also got gorgeous artwork by Aaron Cooter.
Yeah.
Like,
I did flip through that.
Different than the previous run, but very, very nice.
Matt seems like a guy who generally, you want to see him taking a moral stand and being like a tough guy who fights for it.
And you get a lot of that this
But time. Sometimes he's got to take his licks like his dad.
Now he's a priest that beats the shit out of you.
Yes.
He does do that. I would like to mention the fourth issue of Titans. Randy, you mentioned that because of, like, the DC did that side miniseries, what was the, Nightmares?
Or yeah, Night Terrors.
It kind of slightly derailed the inertia of some of the Dawn of DC books. But I have been really am enjoying getting back into Titans as that's gotten back going again. It's on issue 4 now.
Yep.
They're setting up the story that's going to be the Beast Boy thing. That's, I forget what it's called, Beast World. And a clash between the Titans and, like, the Suicide Squad, or Amanda Waller maybe manipulating other stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to mention about this issue, aside from, like, oh, I love all the characterizations on Wally West and...
it opens with a continuation Changeling. Of Beast Boy and Raven's relationship.
Which is, like, really good.
And Taylor has done a great job of defining that relationship and showing, like, real characteristics of a romantic relationship.
And there's an evolution, too. In the last issue, Raven said, a little bit of you has rubbed off on me.
Yeah.
She's like, I, this is something where I would have once gone and kind of just, like, stewed in my gloom about it, and she's like, I'm not going to do that right now. And I liked that. This issue has some threats that show up that are treated seriously, but are threats that I used to think were kind of a little hokey.
Yep.
And they're handled well. But maybe what I wanted to most mention was Nicola Scott. She's a Australian artist, and I think this is some of her best work ever.
It's phenomenal.
It's very detailed, too. It's both kind of classic old-school superhero look, but it's almost like, it reminds me of what I liked about, say, John Byrne way back in the 70s and 80s and stuff like that. It's like this really, really believable, cool-looking superhero stuff.
Well, she also takes care in backgrounds. So much detail work.
Yeah, there's...
It's
insane. It is. Anything else?
Yeah, speaking of Tom Taylor, we've got another second issue, although it's issue 107.
Uh-huh. Yep.
But we got the second part of Nightwing's Pirate Adventures.
Yes.
Which is, he's not going back to pirate times.
Right, which I misunderstood. I went ahead and assumed it was straight pirate things. Yep. It's modern piracy.
It's a modern piracy thing. It's a good premise.
I like this idea of expanding on what Bloodhaven and real is.
Was that a new reveal?
That's new. I thought it was a great idea.
He has a reason for why Bloodhaven is called Bloodhaven, and I'm like, oh, that's
it's actually
good.
Pretty cool.
And it actually makes that dumb name work.
Yes. Which I have always found it a slightly dumb name, but also a cool name.
I got used to it, but I've always thought it was a dumb name. I've gotten used to enough that when I say Bloodhaven, I don't think I'm saying a 90s Image comic anymore. But it was created in those 90s Image comic times. And
I believe it was
name.
Foisted upon Chuck Dixon when he did it. Now, you know, something else that's wild about this, Randy, is that it is utilizing a part of its history that I think we would all agree is one of the dumbest things in Nightwing's history, when he got amnesia and he said, I'm not Dick Grayson, I'm Rick Grayson.
And he's using it well.
Shot in the head by KG Beast.
I love writers that... You don't have to... I think Dave Filoni on the Star Wars stuff kind of is a good example of how you do this. Maybe you might think that Lucas made some dopey decisions in the prequels, but if play your cards right and tell good stories, then you can acknowledge some dopey stuff and you can kind of make it cool again.
Yep.
I mean, I joke about it, but, like, he had was it Mando who said wizard, which was one of the dopiest things in the prequels when baby Anakin says that.
Yep.
And he did that, and I was like, it has lapped itself. It is now kind of cool. Anyway, yes, he is taking stupid stuff from the Rick Grayson era, treating it seriously, and finding, I suspect, much better stories than the originals.
Yeah. There's also Superman number 8, which is also somehow Superman entered 50 or something like that.
Yeah.
So the Ben Fisher covers. Introduces a new villain. Who Lex Luthor locked away at some point.
Chained, I believe.
And then an issue of Moon Knight, which is leading up to the death of Moon Knight.
Yep.
And then the new Moon Knight number 1, because that's how comics work.
So what is the death of Moon Knight?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think we can presume
he's not going to literally die, and that's the end of all Moon Knight stories ever.
But probably will happen. Mark Spector will die for a bit. He's been dead before, more than once. And his brother from the comics, what's his name, the Moon Shadow or whatever he is, that guy might take over as Moon Knight for a while, or someone else will take over as Moon Knight for a while.
That guy's a more extreme Moon Knight.
8-Ball will become Moon Knight.
I saw this. This is I need to read the comic, but it's weird to me that 8-Ball is being...
It's weird and it's awesome.
But yeah, so when almost any character, even the characters that we think of as, like, sort of B or Z grade characters, when they showed up, chances are they were taken seriously in the 70s comic or whatever where they showed up in. And this is just kind of going back to that.
Yeah.
There is, it's not like there's no, not a little bit of humor around, as I recall, 8-Ball's early appearances in it.
Right.
But in the end, what he wants to do is show this to be an interesting person and to find the story to tell with him and not just make him a one-note joke.
Yeah. And then I also want to mention Catwoman comes out this week.
Yes,
that is a continuation of the Gotham War.
Yes. This has some big big interactions between Batman and Catwoman.
Yep.
This
is actually, in a way, the sort of the penultimate issue, because there's a Red Hood issue next week which will focus on Red Hood, and then there's a finale.
Right. But I've read, they did, the Red Hood was like a what, little two-parter thing?
Yeah, the second part's coming out.
Because I like the first part of it.
It's good, it's just a little side story about Red Hood.
Yep.
Red Hood seems to be one of the people who's going to be very affected coming out of this crossover.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I'm continuing to enjoy the small crossover that is Gotham War.
Yeah. And then I wanted to do a real quick shout-out also, Star Trek Halloween number 3. This is 3 of 4. I'm always wary of weekly series. I'm like, did you guys just not have confidence in this? But this has been super fun. They're using the old Star Trek villain, Red Jack. They introduce another old Star Trek villain in this one.
Oh, nice.
It very well. It's been really good, and I think every issue has had something fun to recommend it. So I would definitely recommend, if you like Star Trek or horror, or especially if you like both, give that a read.
You know, makes sense to me for them to go weekly, because then they get all the Halloween comics out in October.
That, I mean, that made sense, yeah.
And I've only read the first issue of this, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. Nice to see a callback to an original series villain, and if they're bringing in some other, like, next-gen or whatever era villain, yeah. That sounds fun to me.
Yeah, yeah. It's a blast, and Star Trek fans would love it, horror fans would love it, everybody should read it. Unless you hate Star Trek and or horror, then you will hate it. All right, let's take a break, and then we're going to talk about some news and some trailers and stuff. All right, so let's start with a remembrance of Keith Giffen, who died just before New York Comic Con. I'd heard he had a stroke, but I've also heard cancer, and maybe it's related.
Yeah, I haven't delved into the specifics on it.
He was about 70, which is not that old.
Honestly, yeah, pretty young in the big scheme of things with modern medicine. It's funny because Giffen, who was both writer and artist, is like kind of not generally mentioned among like the big legends. You know, he has devoted fans, but
if you had asked me 2 weeks ago, hey, what do you think of Keith Giffen? I would have been like, oh yeah, Justice League International. He's solid. Yeah. I've disliked as much of his stuff as I've liked.
Yeah.
He did a Suicide Squad reboot that I did not like at all.
Yeah.
He tended to take big swings and do weird things, and
yeah.
He was definitely coasting along. He kept trying to recreate Justice League International a little bit
right.
Without DeMatteis as co-writer.
Admittedly, the fans also kind of forced that on him.
Yeah, they did. But it's like, the reason that worked, a lot of it was Jim DeMatteis did the scripting.
Right.
And Giffen was the guy. Giffen is a story guy and an artist.
Yep.
And then he did kind of a not-so-great Image book called Trencher, which some people love, but I thought was terrible.
Did you come to Barry Giffen?
I am making a point, sir.
Okay.
I'm laying groundwork.
Oh, keep going.
What I'm saying is, I mostly, when I thought of Giffen, thought of the disappointments.
Yep.
And then after he passed, and people started talking about him, I'm like, oh, right. He did a lot of the Legion stuff I love, both with Paul Levitz and with Tommy Mary Beerbohm.
Yep.
You know, love Justice League International. There was something else notably. Oh, he was a script. He did the
English
script
adaptation
for Battle Royale.
Yeah, the Japanese manga that's so hugely influential.
So I have at least three things in my collection that are like beloved things that come from Keith Giffen.
He was also the lead writer on Annihilation.
Yes, and Annihilation was brought up, and I forgot about that.
And
he's the one who reinvented Drax.
Right, yep. The Drax you know in the movies, although not exactly his, was he did the heavy lifting on it. And, you know, that was a reinvention of it,
yeah.
Drax, as a somewhat more Riddick-type, knife-wielding character.
Yeah.
But, you know, and you know, theoretically I might have been like, oh, that's too different. But Jim Starlin, who created Drax, had already redone a few versions of Drax. There was one in the 90s, I'm sure y'all remember this, where Drax was kind of like a dopey Hulk type.
Yeah.
He was all muscle and no brains.
Yep.
And so, yeah, it was time for a new vision of him, and boy, did it stick.
Yeah.
I hope he got some kind of residuals or consultancy fee or something like that.
Also, I think he did. I think
also
he did.
For us, anything. I know we talked about it last week, Dave, but 52?
Right. 52, which was DC's landmark weekly series, which they have done weekly series before. Action Comics was a weekly right. for a brief time. And for a few years.
Very creative.
This was meant to occur a weekly series that had like four sort of running stories in it that came out after, what was the crossover? Infinite Crisis?
Yes, it was where basically Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman went on not vacation, but they basically.
For various reasons, their friendship split up and they kind of all took a step back. And so it was a lot of the lesser known characters in the DC Universe. And they. The book took place in quasi real time in that sense that. If it was right now, Halloween would be happening in the comic.
Yep.
It all kind of happened. It corresponded with the week it came out. But Keith Giffen, this project was shocking that it came out as well as it did. He did the layouts for the whole thing.
Yeah, it's
he did the
super
layouts for
impressive.
All 52 issues.
Yep.
Like, which is nuts. I know that everybody who had to work on this had to be like a consummate professional and work kind of like a machine. But they also had those amazing covers, of course, from
J.G. Jones.
I know that had to have started well in advance to have been as good as they were.
He also co-created Rocket Raccoon, Jaime Reyes, and Lobo.
Lobo, yeah. Like
all three of those. He also created Ambush Bug, which led to Deadpool, but I'm willing to forgive him for that.
The Jaime Reyes thing is really important.
Jaime Reyes
because,
is pretty notable,
I mean,
yeah.
That was a wonderful
story. He presided
story.
Over what I think we would all agree is the best era
yes.
of yep. that character.
Yep.
You know, and that was the character
with
was
Rogers
most potent, and... you know, at his launch. So,
yeah. Do you remember some 90s characters? Do you remember the Heckler or Vexed?
Yeah, I got Heckler because...
But...
That was the team up of the Exact Legion team. It was Giffen Wright storytelling and Tom and Mary Beerbaum from the Legion.
It was fun.
It was.
And that character's gone. I've never seen the Heckler anywhere else. And Vexed was a like weird gods come to earth thing with art by, oh man, I want to say it was the guy from Exiles. Mike
McCone, yeah.
I think it was one of his first things. And it was really cool and weird too. Like, Giffen was all about doing sort of weird, unusual stuff.
According to like people, like Gail Simone wrote a really nice remembrance of him, and one of the things she said is that when she was breaking into the industry, she did get some pushback. You know, obviously there's some misogynistic pushback and stuff like that, but she said the majority of the pushback she got came from contemporary creators, like people breaking in like her
age, yeah,
and that a lot of the old guard were actually pretty nice to her. But she said one of the most welcoming people was Keith Giffen,
yeah.
And she did some work with him. She had been influenced by him, so she said some very sweet things about him. He was kind of, I think, known as a curmudgeon, but like I think not like maybe the curmudgeon with the heart of gold kind mm-hmm. of guy.
Yeah, he had a reputation for being very
irascible.
Very irascible. Yes. Yeah.
Speaking of weird things, he tried. He also did that Scooby Apocalypse book.
Oh, that was good.
Wow. Yeah,
that was good.
It was good.
So, yeah, the thing was, like, I felt kind of sadder about this than I have about some of the Legends, maybe in part because he did not quite get his full due, but, yeah. Like, he was recognized. He was recognized, for sure. But also, he had some sort of formative stuff. Like, when I was just getting into DC for the first time, John Byrne was doing Superman, Frank Miller had just recently wrapped up Batman Year One, a lot of good stuff was going on, but the first Justice League that I really got into was Justice League International.
Yeah.
That was that weirdo team with Blue Beetle and Booster Gold and Fire and Ice and John Jones trying to keep all those people reined in. And so I have a lot of affinity for his stuff, and I really liked his kind of classic Legion stuff, which included he drew the Great Darkness Saga. It's like perhaps the best-known Legion story.
Yep.
I would say it is the best-known Legion story.
It is one of the best Legion stories.
And then in the 90s, he did the... sort of subversive 5 years later run that had the kind of edgelord style dark take on, it was a galactic depression and Earth was an occupied world and all
yep.
that stuff.
Yep.
And I really liked it. I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but like you can't say he wasn't willing to, what's the old writer's adage, kill your darlings.
Oh, yeah.
He did both a very classic traditional Legion, and he did a subversive.
He's a special one to kill your darlings if your darling is Karate Kid. He used to joke that he killed Karate Kid like three times.
I've run some DC role-playing games, and this was actually just a little bit of text back and forth thing, Nick, but do you recall we did a thing where I had used Lobo in it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it was like... I am not like what you call the biggest Lobo fan, but the Lobo that's a little kind of funny, mm-hmm. you know, the one like I the one that I liked best was on the Superman animated series from the 90s. He's a super fun character, and Giffen, you know, was working at him at multiple stages of his character development from way back when he was in Omega Men, and I'm like, that is a character I do like, you know.
Yeah.
He is a fun fly in the ointment for Goody Two Shoes characters.
Honestly, I think if you've read any DC comics within the past like 30 years, you've read one of his books,
right? Or seen his influence.
He has written so much for DC Comics. Yep. It's insane. I just looked at his list, and it's as long as my arm.
Yeah. So this is you know, raise a bottle for Giffen. Have an Oreo cookie in the John Jones tradition. Oreos with milk.
He got his last bwahaha.
He got his last bwahaha, which is. It is satisfying, even though it is sad.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Guillermo del Toro recently was interviewed and revealed that the Star Wars movie he's not doing was going to be a rise and fall of Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah.
Which sounds cool, but I remember that David Goyer wrote it.
Oh. I didn't read this article, so that's a little...
Guillermo del Toro is yeah, would it be cool? We were really happy about it. He's like, it's one of those 30 screenplays that goes away. He's like, sometimes I'm bitter, sometimes I'm not. He's like, look, you can't be mad about things that don't happen. He's like, I trust the universe. I'm like, that's a very zen way to be. Like, yes. I wouldn't be that if I'd lost the ability to work on Star Wars and I was like Guillermo del Toro. That's a big thing.
I wonder how much of Del Toro's his self would be able to come through in a movie like that,
yeah.
Or if like Star Wars,
you know,
would kind of
Hellboy,
rein it in.
Which was a big property, and you know, even I don't love his Hellboy movies, but although they have a lot of fun stuff in them.
Now, do you mean would anyone be banging the monsters? Because yes, would, that's in every Guillermo del Toro movie. Someone's gonna bang Jabba the Hutt's slug.
But here's the thing: he
Jaegers
loves...
did not bang each other.
There was definitely Monster Six somewhere hidden in that movie.
If I may,
sorry.
Guillermo del Toro is a guy who loves monsters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he sex loves monsters,
but he loves
the monsters. And he likes sympathetic monsters. That's why he's going to be a good fit for Frankenstein,
yeah,
which he's doing an adaptation
100%.
Of. And I would actually, I think I'd have loved to have seen what he wanted to do with Jabba the Hutt. Even if it was Goyer writing, I think his stamp would be on it enough. I'm a little high on him right now, even though I didn't used to be that big a fan, because he killed it on Nightmare Alley.
Yeah,
which I still need to watch.
I'll make
that a point.
I'm going to guess if we had gotten this, that it would have been disappointing in some ways, but it would have had some cool stuff in it. And I would love to see a Jabba Rise and Fall movie. That sounds cool.
Yeah, I just wonder, like, what would the tone be? Would it be a little like I have to feel like it'd be a little like the Godfather 2, Don Corleone early years,
the Godfather 2 of Star Wars.
Yes. but yeah, I think we would have seen, you know, probably a Jabba who was like crapped on by his family and was like the black sheep of the huts at the time. And they were like, "Oh, nobody's going to ever account to you. Look how underweight and underfed you are, you big, you little skinny slug."
What if it was all about weight gain? Like the whole movie is about how Jabba got fat.
Gotta get swole. Gotta do reps.
Get those gains, bro.
it's a possibility, but this is a project we bring up. It's a lost project.
It's a lost project.
It won't happen,
yeah,
unless things turn around and they somehow woo him back. That generally does not happen.
No, and they've moved on to other stuff. There's three other in development. So
they were smart. They'd reversed course. I wonder if that got lost when they sort of panicked about all things Star Wars a few years ago. They're like, oh, we don't know what people like anymore.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
they seem to like Mando. Make 100 shows quick.
Yeah. They like Imperial Security Bureau based on Andor. So next up in the, I think this is actually still potentially happening. Gary Delberman and James Wan's Atomic Monster Banner are working on a live action version of the Disney Gargoyles show.
Who's working on it?
Gary Delberman, who you may know him as the writer of the Conjuring movies.
Okay. Those are pretty good movies.
Oh, sorry, no. Conjuring spin-off movies.
Oh, no! They're very different from the Conjuring movies, which were, I believe, written by Lee Winnell.
So we're talking about Annabelle.
Annabelle Creation, and The Nun.
Oof. Those are all shit movies.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's
they're kind of varying degrees.
They're shit-ish.
Yeah.
So he's making the Gargoyles movie.
Yep, not
writing,
a lot of...
directing?
He is writing.
Okay.
He also wrote It Chapter 2, which is also
I am at
great.
Least open to the idea that, oh, sometimes this is the project somebody was waiting for.
It Chapter 2 is not bad.
I'm not sure that...
It's not without its moments.
I think you need... To have me excited about this, which I'm not a big Gargoyles fan in general. Like, I liked it,
yeah.
But I don't have the love that a lot of people do. To be excited about a Gargoyles live action, it needs to be someone who's done a bunch of really great movies, and he's done okay and bad movies.
Yep. If Lee Whannell Randy was doing it, we would be excited, because he's
yes.
done some...
Yeah, if Lee Whannell was announced, I'd be all about it, but... Yeah, this is the guy who wrote maybe the not great spinoffs.
Yeah.
I mean, you never know. That's
right.
What I point.
But I feel like this would invite the cautiously pessimistic.
Yes.
Yes, agreed.
Okay. They'd have to do work a little bit more to get me on the optimistic
cautiously
side.
Pessimistic is actually my brand.
It's your exclusive brand. Pioneered.
No.
Relentlessly pursued.
That's not true. My other brand is hating the cold.
I mean, I guess so.
I have multitudes.
Oh, wow.
DC's bringing back Elseworlds, which I love Elseworlds. I think yep. they never should have gotten rid of this imprint.
I agree.
I don't. I was never quite clear. You know, it's basically their what if.
Mm-hmm. So there...
And they the first one, the first official one that they did, I believe, was Gotham by Gaslight.
Yes.
And then there's been
it wasn't. Gotham by Gaslight was the second one. The first one was Batman Holy Terror.
Was that really the first
yep.
one? Wow, and that's the one that they had to hide for a little while because it criticized the Catholic Church.
That was Ellen Brenner, a well-known sci-fi and DC writer.
Yep.
And Norm Breyfogle.
Yep.
And it is a fantastic story.
I love Holy Terror.
It's Batman is basically raised by the Christian state and
right.
then finds out they're Christo-fascists.
Yep. And his
timely
costume,
as ever. They should reprint that.
His costume came from a, like, what do they call it, like a passion play or
yeah,
whatever,
yeah.
Where it's like, that's this sort of devil bat costume.
Yep.
But among
the other things in that run, they mentioned Kingdom Come.
Do you remember that the Waynes were killed by like because they were providing refuge to like what do you call it gay people?
Yes,
they were providing
yeah.
refuge to
yep.
To people who were like immigrants and stuff
yeah.
like that, who were being persecuted under this Christo-fascist
reign. Very timely, great
yeah.
read. I recommend it.
Yeah.
It's hard to find. They should really put it back in print.
They last time they had it, they did include it in one of those big Elseworlds compilations.
Right.
So
I think
it is.
It may still be.
It
one
may
of
still
those.
Be out there.
Kingdom Come, Batman and Dracula, Red Reign, Superman, Red Sun, Just League the Nail. Those are the ones mentioned. They did, but they did a year where that was their theme for their annuals.
Yeah,
and they had like a pirate Batman and a future like a
Justice
War of the Worlds style Justice League, the Justice Riders.
There was a I think John Byrne did the Superman where he crash landed in was it in the Civil War or
yes,
was it
was
in the Revolutionary War?
Well, there was a Revolutionary War. There was also the Blue, the Gray, and the Bat, which was Batman of the Civil War.
Right.
There was the Darkest. There was. What, Darkest Bullets or something? There was one where Batman gets the Green Lantern ring.
Yep.
There's a lot of mashup stuff they did, and those
and
all pretty good.
And sometimes it would just be like a weird thing, like Howard Chaykin's like Batman Houdini thing, where
right?
they had really beautiful art by Mark Chiarello, I remember.
Yeah.
But I liked all those oddball ones. I'm not sure I like all the at least the initial bracket of ones coming out, but I'm certainly willing to give them some time to win me over because it's a good imprint.
Y'all know how I like alternate worlds. Like, this is one of my
yep.
things. And
yeah.
so I'm super happy to see it coming back. And Dave, you were sort of poo-pooing, and I'm like, oh, but this... So the ones they announced, Gotham by Gaslight, The Kryptonian Age, a 12-issue series by Andy Diggle and Leandro Fernandez.
I do like Diggle being involved.
Diggle and Fernandez is a great artist.
Yeah, it is.
And a 12-issue exploration of, like, 19th century Justice League and that kind of thing, the secret Kryptonian history. That all sounds cool to me.
Yep.
I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. The next thing is Batman the Barbarian by Greg Smallwood. Y'all know I'm very skeptical of writer-artists.
Yeah.
But Smallwood is a fantastic artist.
I can't remember what...
This is a Batman's origin against a rugged medieval Earth.
Is Smallwood the guy who worked with Tom King?
He worked with Tom King on Human Target.
He's a good artist, for sure.
He's been on a bunch of stuff.
Didn't he work
like.
With Lemire on Moon Knight?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
He's
okay.
a good artist. So that I'm excited about.
No, Batman Barbarian's gonna suck, but go ahead.
Then there's Dark Knights of Steel, All Winter... So this is a Viking-flavored Dark Knights of Steel, which is the fantasy thing that Tom Taylor created.
Right.
This
Another writer's going to do it, and it's going to suck, too.
It's not by Tom Taylor. It's by Jay Kristoff, who I don't know.
How, Dave? You're the pessimist.
yeah. And but Tom Taylor is doing a sequel to Dark Knights of Steel.
Oh, is he?
Yes, he announced that recently.
Oh, okay.
And it's going to be in the Elseworlds bracket, which, by the way, Deceased is an Elseworlds.
Yeah.
So they're probably going to what they'll do what they do with Elseworlds.
Have they been labeling a black label?
They'll move stuff over. No, it's not. It's not okay. Labeled. They'll move stuff over to Elseworlds that should be Elseworlds.
So is there going to be Black Label and Elseworlds
Yeah,
now?
Black Label something else. It's more...
Okay. But, you know, that does make sense. They will go ahead and take any reprints of Gotham by Gaslight. It'll get the Elseworlds banner once again. Yeah.
Anyway, the first two projects sounded good, and more Dark Knights of Steel looks... The art for Viking Dark Knights of Steel looks awesome.
Okay.
And then we've got Green Lantern Dark, which reimagines the DC Universe as a dark fantasy wasteland where monsters overrun a post-apocalyptic Earth. And yes, that does sound a little bit like Otto the Bus Driver's pitch to the school, which is a Simpsons reference from about 25 years ago.
Sure.
But it does look like this cool, the Green Lantern looks cool.
It's about a bus driver who fights vampires in a post-apocalyptic war zone.
So it's a the Green Lantern who wields the green flame that can return light to a dark world. Has been missing, and only on the isolated island of New England, the horrors only get worse by night. And I'm like, that all sounds interesting. I'll
allow for it. You know what's interesting is a lot of times the opening for the shot for these is kind of something grimdark.
Yeah.
Batman Holy Terror is grimdark.
Yeah.
What do you call it? Batman Gotham by Gaslight is Batman versus Jack the Ripper, essentially.
Really to be able to do utopian, like all Elseworlds.
It's true. You know what was one of the fun, weird ones? Although the writer wasn't somebody great on this, it was like Ron Mars or something, but. There was a Green Lantern one that I kind of liked that was like their Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon one.
Oh, I forgot about that one.
Yeah. I believe at some point, and it may have been a version of Kyle, I can't remember, and as opposed to Hal, or maybe it was an original character, but somebody, he had like a Green Lantern ring, but he had to like climb some mountain for some ritual and like faced Oni demons or something like that. He had to do it without the ring. And then I was like, that was pretty cool.
And then they're doing a DC vs. Vampires World War V, so a sequel to that. And also... something called Batman Nightfire that is by Clay and Seth Mann, who are writer-artist twin brothers, apparently. That one I can't quite get a read on.
Yep.
It just seems like they were like, yeah, you guys do your own Batman. But amongst all those projects, there's two that sound legitimately good, there's two that sound interesting, and there's two that I'm not so sure of. And
there's a lot of swords in there for a parent person who's not a big fantasy fan.
I don't like fantasy, but I do like alternate worlds.
It's okay if Batman carries the sword.
It's okay if Batman carries the sword.
An elf? No.
Yeah, no. No elves. There are no elves anywhere in these alternates that I can find, and that's a good
thing.
That's
a win.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Anyway, I'm just glad to have the imprint back, even if all these are misfires. I want them to be more. This was a Didio thing. It was one of these other weird Didio things. Like, he didn't like Elseworlds.
He didn't like Nightwing. He didn't like Elseworlds.
He didn't like DC. I don't know what that dude thought he was doing there.
You know, as we find out a bit more about Didio recently from interviews and things like that, it kind of does start to fall into place.
Well, also, now we know, I mean, that he's kind of a jerk. That, like, the Batwoman, he's the one who scotched the Batwoman marriage.
Yeah.
And now we're like, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that dude did a lot of damage in the time that he was there.
He kind of did.
And they're still recovering from it.
Yeah. Brad Meltzer probably being foremost among damage
that's definitely
he inflicted upon us.
Yes. Brad Meltzer's launching an Image imprint with people. I don't know if you saw this.
Sure.
Brad Meltzer, Jeff Johns are launching a new Image imprint.
Really?
Yep.
Jeff Johns is like, I had so much, such a great time working with him.
Yeah.
I miss those Dr. Light days. Ooh, boy.
Yeah, I forget what that's called. I gotta find it now, because there's a... they're going to be launching through Image. They're going to print through Image, but it is a new... it's a new imprint that has him and Jeff Johns and I think a bunch of other
losers.
good artists is what I was going
to
say.
Right, that's what I meant to say too.
So essentially like Skybound or
it's
something.
It's called Ghost Machine.
Okay.
And that makes sense. It's Jeff Johns, Gary Frank, so the GI robot thing, whatever it is.
And Light or whatever it was.
Brian Hitch, Francis Menapool, Brad Meltzer, Peter Tomasi. Yeah, these are all people who I don't like.
I don't know. Tomasi has done some good stuff.
No, I don't dislike any of them personally. I just don't like most of their work, and that includes Tomasi. I've never been a huge fan
of him. I liked his Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah. So, Ghost Machine. If you want to read books Randy won't like, Ghost Machine.
Did we mention in the Elseworlds discussion the Justice Riders?
We
did.
Yeah, that was a good one.
The only one that I didn't mention was JSA Liberty Files, which I really liked.
Oh, that was interesting.
By the way, I believe I believe JLA or JSA, the Golden Age from Robinson, was generally relegated to Elseworlds.
Or do they? No, they moved it. Do they move it back out when it became Starman?
Maybe
or
it's Black Label now, but I don't know. You know what's interesting about Justice Riders? It was Justice League International people, if memory serves.
That's
primarily.
Right. Yeah, that's correct.
Like Booster was in there. Yep. Blue Beetle was like a guy who had like steampunk, like a Gatling guns suit.
Yeah. But it also had like the Trinity and.
Did it?
I'm pretty sure it had Wonder Woman
and Batman, but both of them were in Justice League International.
Yep.
Yeah.
I believe it's something that I read somewhere a little bit of story behind it, and it did have a weird build-up, like, oh, at one time it was going to be this, and then it kind of got diverted and became a different project. But eventually found its way back to being the slightly weird but very cool thing that it was. A cool steampunkish JLA Western.
I have that one. I can't remember if it's in those trades now.
It's
either.
Somewhere in one of them, the Justice League one.
I bought a lot of those Elseworlds. I have a ton of those on my shelf. I have all the annuals, I think.
I have a fondness for even some of the ones that are middling.
and there's a lot of those.
There's a lot of them. Because there's still always some cool ideas in there.
Oh, Batman Thrill Killer?
Thrill Killer by Dan Brereton.
The Dan Brereton one? Yep, that was super cool.
Man, if I start thinking about it, I can actually come up with a lot of them.
I'm just looking through the...
Batman did dominate the line.
There's a lot of Batman. Castle of the Bat, which was the Batman Frankenstein.
Yes, I own that.
Yeah, I have that one too. Doom That Came to Gotham, which is back in print now.
Oh yeah, the first full Lovecraftian sort of Batman sort of deal.
Looking in through all the non-Batman ones, there's a lot of Batman ones. Superman got a few too, though. There was Son of Superman that actually introduced Jonathan Kent, a version of Jonathan Kent.
Yep.
There was Superman the Dark Side, or Superman is raised by Dark Side.
Yep.
Cal, which is in medieval England, and he becomes a blacksmith and forges Excalibur.
An Arthurian, Arthurian Superman.
Speeding Bullets, that's the one where Kal-El is raised by Thomas and Martha Wayne, murdered by a mugger, and he becomes Batman. Elseworld's Finest Supergirl and Batgirl was interesting. Basically, it's like it was there was no Batman, there was no Superman, there was Batgirl and Supergirl.
Right.
That was really good. I like that one.
I remember Eric from Tribe Comics foisted that upon me once upon a time in the early 2000s.
Wow, I've missed this. This is a 2002 JLA Shogun of Steel.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I do sort of remember that. What I would like to see of the new line is an embrace of some of their other heroes outside of Batman, but I don't mind seeing some Batman ones. I understand he's anchor. He's got a good lore.
Yeah. I really like that imprint. I'm glad to have it back. And then before we get to the trailers, one last thing. At New York Comic Con, Marvel announced their next big crossover after Gang War, which is the Spider-Man one that's coming up right recently. But next year, they're doing something called Blood Hunt, which is basically, it's Jed MacKay writing, X-Men artist Pepe Larraz and Marta Gracia doing art.
It's going to look beautiful.
And it is vampires. I mean, it looks like vampires versus Marvel.
Yep. They must have seeded this because they've been doing the vampire stuff with Tim Seeley lately. He did those series of miniseries. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, focused on like a group of vampires.
They were like renegade vampires of some kind. And Blade has been back for a bit.
Yep.
Blade's daughter has been introduced. They've got some vampire community stuff percolating. If you want, once upon a time, Jubilee was a vampire, other weird stuff.
So, Jed MacKay, it looks like it's going to be mostly on Jed MacKay's books.
Okay.
Because he mentions Avengers, Midnight Mission from Moon Knight, Doctor Strange, those are his books.
Yeah.
But he also mentions Miles Morales and Blade, which I don't know if he'll be using them or if he'll be crossing over into those two books.
Interesting.
But, it looks fun.
Well, in the other book, they also just, I forgot to post this, but they did post that the Jonathan Hickman is going to be relaunching Ultimate Spider-Man.
Right, and I think there's a, I don't know if it's a rumor or something I heard, that Peter may be, like, more of the middle-aged Peter.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as
Peter
well.
Peter B. Parker style Peter. Which is interesting, because actually, at this point, we don't need a teen Peter.
No.
We've got Miles.
So
an older Peter makes sense.
But Hickman said he's, like, going to reinvent the character again, so we'll see.
And I look forward to his boring take. I'm sorry, I look forward to his take.
You mean his infographic take?
Yeah, it's like... Yes, I need a map of Manhattan with Spider-Man areas overlaid in a grid format.
Dave, I like maps. Maps are fun.
I like Elliot R. Brown maps from the 80s.
Yes, and only those.
I like, you like Watership old, Down maps.
I like old stuff. Now, I'll let Hickman have his shot. I do think the idea of the older Parker is not a bad idea. Lines up a little bit with, of course, the movies, Spider-Verse movies, and yeah, we've seen Pete's story relaunched often enough, so yeah, do something a little different.
Yeah. All right, let's talk trailers. Just have a few. We got a new Scott Pilgrim Takes Off trailer. This is the anime that they're doing.
We're still all a little, I think, puzzled as to the intent behind this.
So this is they did a teaser, they showed us a sequence, and now it's a trailer. And in none of this did they give me any indication this is anything that is not in the movie. Like, they're just showing us the movie. And I'm like, right, like I know they showed the movie, but, like, give us something that indicates what.
Well, there are definitely sequences here that I saw here that were not in the movie.
But like, not. Like, I want to see Knives' dad or something else that was literally cut out of the movie.
But this is called Scott Pilgrim, what? Takes off?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still a little puzzled by it.
Animation looks
Randy,
great.
It had the Mortal Kombat theme music.
It did have the Mortal Kombat theme.
The roll call with it was like, you know, Scott Pilgrim, Knives Chow.
Yeah. It's a very cleverly formed trailer.
Yep. But yeah, like seeing like Scott Pilgrim waiting for his package from. What was it, Netflix instead of Amazon? Or what? Didn't they change something a little bit?
It was Amazon TA in the books. I don't know what it might be.
Yeah, the whatever Ramona Flowers is delivering for.
He's waiting for a Netflix desk.
But that's a scene we know, though.
Yeah.
And it wasn't exactly like new stuff. They've said that this is both uses more stuff from the comics, also some original stuff. But we kind of haven't seen those elements. And it would be nice if they did something that just showed, like, you know, a 2 or 3 minute sequence of just
one
stuff.
Scene from Ramona Flowers' point of view would go a long way for me.
Yeah. What about a goofy boy who just doesn't know what to do and he needs to learn a lesson?
Yeah.
And everybody is there to help him learn that lesson.
Here's the thing. I love the graphic novels. I love the movie. I should be excited for this, but I'm like, if you're not doing something different, I don't know why you're just doing this.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
He's a cartoon man.
He's a cartoon man now.
he not flesh man, he cartoon man.
speaking of cartoon men, we have the trailer for Invincible Season 2.
Yep.
I soured hard on Invincible Season 1.
You sour because of that finale?
Yes.
Okay.
I soured when Mark's dad used his face to kill a subway full of people.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, this seems excessive. And that's the entire final episode, spoilers. Is basically Invincible getting the shit beat out of him and a bunch of innocent people dying all around him.
It's true.
And I was like, well, I hate this. And I don't really want more of it. And then they showed this trailer and I'm like, oh, right. Even outside of the ultraviolence, the thing I like about Invincible is it is Kirkman does love the shared universe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Around thing that I love about superheroes. And I'm like, oh, man, I do kind of want to see more of this superhero universe he's built. Even though I know he's going to have a bunch of people getting killed, and he thinks that's edgy and fun. And I don't know where the balance is in that. Like, I don't like superhero comics where the innocent people get killed in spite of superheroes or because of superheroes.
Yeah, it's it all reminds me of the what that friend of mine said once upon a time about the movie Unbreakable.
Yeah.
That the creepy home invasion sequence was so dark that that you know the victory that Bruce Willis ultimately has over the invader home invasion guy, he doesn't felt like it didn't make up in his mind for
like
how awful
yeah.
it
yeah.
was.
Yeah. And I get that. And the thing is, like, that's how I feel about a lot of this stuff. And yet, Prime has done The Boys and Gen V, which is the epitome of heroes are scumbags, and I'm really enjoying that. So I know
that is a show
that
like that's the opening point of view is that you're going to skewer heroes and stuff like that. Invincible is weird because, like, it both wants to kind of be, in some ways at least, traditional stories, and, you know, with
and,
Kirkman's...
And also subversive. Turns,
and also subversive or something. I'm not quite sure.
That being said, there was a lot I liked about Season 1. I will definitely watch more of Season 2, even if I wanted to hate watching it.
Yeah, I love Season 1. I'm usually not there for ultraviolence. And that's baked into the comic. I mean, it really just is.
Yeah.
I think they definitely took it to sort of newer heights in the animation, but I love the comic. It was one of the few books where I think Kirkman has, like, nailed an ending that is, like, one of the best endings that he's written.
Interesting.
And I hope that they just continue to get the different character pieces. I mean, that Adam... Did you ever watch the Adam Eve special? The Adam Eve special was really good.
Was it, a one-hour special or something?
Yeah, it was like an hour just focusing on her and, like, her backstory. It was good.
I'll probably watch it before Invincible Season 2
comes on. But, I mean, it's definitely violent. There's some messed up stuff in there. But, again, it kind of captures really good character beats. And the voice cast of this is pretty stellar.
Yeah.
They're bringing in Sterling K. Brown as the big villain in this season. And
just, you know what's weird to me? It's just like... I kind of feel like until his Invincible's dad started, like, smacking people around, it's as if, like, it wasn't an ultra-violent universe. Like, otherwise, wouldn't all these, like, their JLA-type people, wouldn't they be all, like, wearing battle armor and stuff like that if you could get punched in the head and it just squirts your brains out? Like, you wouldn't kind of be acting like the JLA, you would be acting like Garth Ennis' characters.
Well, it's to show that the alien race that Mark comes from and Mark's dad are basically, like, super powerful.
Is there, are there...
They're vulture.
Is he the only source of, like, the ultraviolence?
It's
built into it.
I mean,
it.
There are violence, but Kirk, he is definitely the one punching through people.
Right. It's just weird, like I said... the costume design and the look of it is kind of Marvel DC.
Yeah.
It's just that it's like, what if suddenly somebody started smushing heads?
It's true.
So what if we don't see very often?
That alternate title didn't take. What if smushing heads?
Well, then I'll pitch it to Marvel where they actually have the what if license. Give me my shot, Marvel.
No, that's not the name of a name of a story. It won't work.
What if Venom squish heads?
What if Death of Venomverse?
Okay, and then let's talk about Legacy of the Monsters.
This trailer looks really good.
Wait, is it called that, or is it the word Monarch?
Legacy of Monsters.
Legacy of Monsters. So this is the Godzilla TV show.
Yeah. Which premieres in a couple weeks on Apple TV.
Yep.
And wisely they have wrapped it around the, you know, the organization that hunts and tracks and studies Godzilla's.
So they can do a little bit of, like, conspiracy stuff as well, but they definitely are shying away from the monster effects.
Right. Oh. But it does give them a fairly legit reason to have a decent amount of human interaction and downtime, and not just monsters slugging it out 24/7.
But it also looks like we're going to get some of the average Joe people, like, living in a world where giant monsters are an everyday thing.
Which is some of the cooler stuff in those movies, is that sort of sense of somehow living through this crazy world. I mean, way back when the X-Men came back from the Secret Wars world... And they were in Japan, and a big old dragon came through after them. And I loved the bits that Claremont wrote in there about where, like, because Godzilla had been canon at Marvel for a while, where they're like, oh, yeah, these sirens go off, and people in Japan are talking about, like, yeah, we've dealt with Godzilla before, we know how to evacuate a town, and stuff like that. And I was like, man, this is what a cool... take on it, and this is kind of like the big continuation of that, even though I have not loved the movies, that is a cool aspect of them, and they've got stuff I like.
Yeah.
Well, and you throw in Kurt Russell and Wyatt Russell as sort of legacy Monarch character.
Do we think Kurt Russell's just going to pass the torch, or is he doing a TV show?
No,
he's playing, the main character.
He's a main character.
He's going to be a main character.
His son is playing him.
Yeah. Basically in flashbacks.
Okay. I thought he was going to be playing himself in flashbacks or something like that, and then his son would be next generation.
No, his son is playing his character in the 70s flashbacks.
Okay, that sounds pretty cool.
We're going to flashback to, like, John Goodman, because he was, like, one of the starters of Monarch.
Monarch is my favorite concept out of all those movies. Skull Island, all the way through Godzilla vs. Kong, that has been my part I like about all of it is Monarch, and so I'm glad for them to focus on it.
Yeah.
Because it's been, like, just little bits, and it's like,
where is this going to stream?
Apple Plus.
You like government organizations, I'm just saying.
I love these.
If Randy could join a secret government organization that secretly manipulates democracy, he would do it in a heartbeat.
And hunts monsters? Hell yeah.
I will say that final shot of Godzilla, of, like, going, like, panning up over his tail.
Is he, like, was...
He looks like he was in, like, the desert.
Yeah, like maybe he'd even been, like, sleeping under a sand dune or something. Something like
is
that.
Awesome.
Which is cool looking, yeah.
Look, here's the thing. If you have a helicarrier and a steady paycheck, I'll believe anything you say.
You know, it is too bad that they couldn't wrangle a deal with Marvel and have a crossover movie.
Shield Monarch, that'd be amazing.
Because then they could go ahead and do what was going on in the Marvel comics of the 70s.
I want Dugan to pick up Godzilla by his shrunken tail and slam him into a wall.
Wasn't the helicarrier that was tasked to find Godzilla, wasn't the Leviathan?
Called Leviathan, yes.
Yep. And once upon a time, Marvel's Hercules, to save a friend, caught Godzilla's foot to keep him from stomping down, and did all his Hercules strength and pushed Godzilla and knocked him over. Yeah. That was dope.
Yep.
I would love to see the Marvel characters go ahead and interact with Godzilla.
That'd be great.
I think they should, legit, it would be a cool crossover if they were somehow able to work it out.
Don't worry, Dave. Probably about 10 years from now, only one company will own all of the IPs.
Oh, perfect. What a great thing monopolies are.
It will probably be Disney.
I'm sure they'll be great. But that's a pretty good trailer. I actually think this looks like a good, more interesting outlet to me in some ways than the movies.
And Apple has the money to throw it.
It's true.
To do whatever they want.
They made Foundation, which was also not cheap.
No, not cheap.
So, yeah, we'll see. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about a bunch of horror movies and a little bit of TV.
Yay.
Oh, I'm so scared.
It is week 3 of spooky season. And that means we've got more TV and movies to talk about that we've been watching.
Yep.
And we're going to start with Mike Flanagan's latest and final Netflix show, Fall of the House of Usher.
Right. You may know him from such shows as Haunting of Hill House, Haunting of Bly Manor, and Midnight Mass.
Yep. And Midnight Club, although some people don't like that.
Hey, there are some characters in this show that are from Midnight Club, and they're great.
Yep. That one just seemed to was not quite as big a victory in most eyes.
Yeah, it was.
Yep.
All right. We're going to talk about the first four, because Dave has only seen the first four.
Yep.
Nick and I have both finished it.
Yep. As a series, broadly, it is about... A sort of crime family or...
They're not a crime family.
They're pharmaceuticals, you know...
In that sense, they are a crime family.
Yeah, right. They are big pharma and they are corrupt. Yeah, there's a dad with, 6 different kids by 5 different wives, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep,
played by Bruce Greenwood.
Yep.
You may know him from Christopher Pike from the Star Trek 2009 movie.
Or the corpse in Gerald's game.
Which is a bigger part than you'd think.
He's briefly a non-corpse, yes. And so you see the strange events of their lives with some flashbacks and some modern time stuff. Told with elements of Edgar Allan Poe.
Yep.
The names are taken from it. It is the Usher family. They are pursued and interrogated over the years by a police detective named Dupin.
Auguste Dupin.
Yeah, which is based on the detective that Poe created. He was an investigator for
No, he's a lawyer on the show, but he's a detective in the Poe comics.
Right, in the Poe.
Right.
Yes.
His kind of proto-Sherlock Holmes, because it was created, some decades before Sherlock Holmes, but he had elements of that going on.
In this, he is a crusading prosecutor who's trying to bring down the Usher family and the Fortunato Corporation, which Fortunato is also a name familiar to those from Poe. He's played by Carl Lumley.
Yeah,
and which is a fantastic role for him.
Man,
Lumley's always great, but he is spectacular.
This was a real opportunity for him.
This is a showcase for everybody, but I mean, it's Flanagan's Players.
Yes,
but I want to specifically highlight Bruce Greenwood as Roderick Usher.
Yes,
and
he's basically the narrator of this entire series.
Who's his sister? Who's played?
Mary McCormick.
Mary McCormick from Battlestar Galactica, among other things, as Madeline Usher, his sister. They are the kids who grow up.
They have a dark backstory, which I don't want to say too much about, but it has some horrific elements from that are thematically linked to some Poe stories.
Yep.
And there is certainly some sympathy, but they have grown up pretty tough and brutal.
Yep.
And they sort of manage the family's business with an iron fist.
Mm-hmm.
There's questions of who will end up controlling the family, and so the the series follows in that ensemble-like way of, like, most of his shows. Mm-hmm. A pretty broad cast of characters who was a little much for my brain at first. I was like, whoa, there's a lot of people.
You get used to them all, though.
You get used to them all. They all have a unique look and a vibe.
But the formula is interesting because each episode focuses on one of the children.
Yeah. Yes. Which is not unusual because that's kind of what he did in House of...
And they are all
House,
being, they're all being stalked by a sinister figure played by Carla Gugino.
Yes.
And she's amazing in this role, too.
She's great.
Yeah,
I was weirded out that her name is Verna because that was my mom's name, so it was a little odd.
Yeah, it's an unusual name, and it's to hear quite a bit.
But someone I think succinctly described this as Succession, but at the end of every episode, someone gets their comeuppance.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, you know what's interesting is that vibes differently than his other shows, which have all had a somewhat similar vibe of being somewhat dark. Character studies and tragic stories of love and sort of like addiction and other human frailties, but juxtaposed against these very beautiful moments sometimes.
And that's here, but it has more bite.
Yeah. Right. Well, these characters are not the flawed but often likable characters of his other projects. A lot of them are scumbags.
Yeah, they're flawed and horrible individuals.
Just a few examples. There's one son, Prospero, who is aka Perry, who is like a, what is he, 20 something, very young 20 something.
Yeah, he's like 22.
Is looking to set up a pop up club business. He's looking to make his fortune and get the family to pay attention to him.
He wants to make a club orgy club.
Yeah, he wants to make these pop up clubs that are at unique locations in cities where the rich and famous will come out, and it'll be a tradition to have a big orgy in them. And there's some other twists and turns within that, but that's who he is. There is one of the children who is like kind of she handles the PR, right?
Yes.
And she, in addition to some just bizarre kinks, the first of a number of weird bits of kink that you'll see in this show, because these guys have strange appetites. She is just like brutally efficient. When she's talking about managing the death of one of the kids,
yep.
Her plan is very good.
Yeah.
Like, it is, like, both kind of, like, manipulative and sinister, but I was like, that is a good PR plan.
That is played by... That is Kate Siegel.
Yes.
She is amazing. She has been... I mean, she's Mike Flanagan's wife, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that's right.
And has been, like, the star of movies like Hush and every one of his...
She's great. Things. And I like... Clearly enjoying her role as this cruel person.
Well, I think that's what kind of took me... back a little bit, like all the other Mike Flanagan movies and shows have been a little more restrained.
Yeah.
This, they get to cut loose. There's sex, drugs. This is like violence.
It
is violence.
It is not as scary as his, like nowhere near Hill House, but that's okay. It doesn't, not everything has to be Hill House. And even Bly Manor, which some people were like, no, it's not as scary as Hill House. I'm like, well, but Bly Manor, did it tell a good story or not? And it told a great story.
It told a great story.
This one, the things that it adds to the mix, which are kind of fun, well, first of all, there's the Poe elements.
Yeah.
And they're very fun to watch. But there's also a dark sense of humor, I would say. I found myself laughing quite often in, like, at dark and terrible things.
Yes.
Oh man, I forgot to mention one of the kids is Henry Thomas, aka Grown Up E.T. What's his name? Elliot from E.T.
Yep.
He's in all the Mike Flanagan stuff, and he's kind of a slightly oily dude with he's like a little ponytail on the back, and a daughter named Lenore, who I don't know quite where that's all going to play out, but I know she's going to play an important role.
Character in this is named after a Poe thing.
Right.
Which is kind
of
fun.
And these are not strict retellings of Poe stories.
No. But the
elements flicker in and out of, the thematics are in there, but he's making it all his own, just as he did with his other miniseries. It's interesting that he takes existing structures and does really change them so much that they're completely his own.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think, like, oh yeah, he just took a Poe story and just filmed it with with actors or something.
One of the things I like is when I see the shape of a Poe story developing into it, I'm like, oh, that's what he's doing. Like, it's very cleverly done.
It is. Yeah. It is.
I finished this last night.
Yes, and you had a good reaction.
It is my favorite thing Mike Flanagan's done.
That's pretty big stuff because we've liked a lot of his stuff.
I really love his stuff.
I think something we'll talk about in a few minutes is probably my favorite thing of his.
It's really up there. It's up there.
That one was not, you know, it did not make a lot of people's lists initially. I had to kind of root for this movie. Mm-hmm.
So earlier. I want to correct myself. It's not Mary McCormick. It's Mary McDowell.
Mary McDowell.
Or Mary McDonnell. Sorry.
Right.
And then the other inclusion in this show, which is really fun, is Mark Hamill.
Oh, wow, we didn't talk about Mark Hamill. Mark Hamill is having a great time playing.
He is the most cutthroat, craggy voice
fixer
yeah, lawyer guy.
He's the lawyer and enforcer. Objection.
He gets to have so much fun in this role, I loved every scene with him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But this show is great.
Everyone
like Randy,
should watch this.
It's so much fun. If you love Poe, you'll find a lot more to love about it.
And but I will say, like, horror fans are going to like it for the grisliness and macabre elements. But if you are not a horror fan, know that it is not, like, intensely scary, and that I think you will enjoy the spooky stuff and the weird things, as long as you're at least open to... you'd watch the first episode and know. But this is not going to be something that will probably... be like a nightmare-inducing thing, or you're going to worry about something in your shower. I don't know, maybe.
let's move on to the other thing, which I think, Nick, it may be, it's in my top five Mike Flanagan things. That is Dr. Sleep, the director's cut, which is a half hour longer than...
Yep, it's 30 minutes longer.
It's 3-hour movie. There are not a lot of movies I want to watch 3 hours.
It does not feel like
it
3 hours.
It does not. It burns right through.
Well, it's the sequel to The Shining. Yes.
And I watched it originally, the regular cut. I thought it was a good movie.
I loved it.
I don't know if I loved it. I think this one, which sort of expands and gives... a little more breathing room, a little more nuance to all the characters involved. From Danny, who is a grown-up...
Right. It's grown-up. This is mainly,
Torrance.
You know, if you were to just real quickly say what the premise is, it's about something that happens to the grown-up Danny from The Shining.
Yeah, played by Ewan McGregor, who is phenomenal in this.
Yeah,
and it's a great role in the director's cut, he gets to show every facet of this character as kind of a scumbag in some
regard. His breakout movie was what? What's the
Ewan
one?
Ewan McGregor's?
Yes.
The
drug thing, the heroin.
Oh, Trainspotting.
Trainspotting. And this, is, in a way, is an interesting reflection of
it
that.
It is.
And it's also, I think most people know that Stephen King himself didn't love The Shining movie by Kubrick, because it kind of plays out rather differently from his book.
Yep.
And the addiction issues that were such a big thing in the book, The Shining, alcohol addiction.
Kubrick kind of got rid of.
He kind of got rid of. And so that Jack Torrance in the movie is just kind of like, he's a little off kilter pretty quick.
Yeah.
But the movie has all its own qualities, and this sequel to it is both sequel to Shining the movie, as well as a story that integrates elements from the original Shining, including those addiction issues, and the book, Dr. Sleep. So that, when we see grown-up Danny Torrance initially, he is struggling with drugs and alcohol, and he is hitting rock bottom in a way that's pretty intense.
It is. We're also, Carl Lumley, another, like we've talked about, is always good, but his rendition of Dick Halloran, which was...
Scatman Crothers' character from The Shining... He still talks to Danny sometimes in spiritual shining way.
And they get a little bit more time together and kind of what they talk about. All of it just hits home and kind of explores different avenues that I wasn't expecting.
It's a surprisingly emotional movie at times.
It is.
And it is not. It is also not full horror. The way I was sort of telling people about it, because I didn't want anybody to go in and say... I wasn't scared by that. What I was saying was it almost was like a dark urban fantasy or dark fantasy or something like that. It had the elements that I think of as like Sandman and stuff like that. And that there's some jump scares. There's things that'll scare you.
There's terrifying things.
But it is also about like almost like the lore of The Shining and this mysterious group that like hunts people who have The Shining.
Am I mistaken that when they kill the kid when the knot kills it, that's extended?
Yes, it felt a lot more brutal. In this one.
It is brutal and terrifying.
I remember it being tough before, but particularly in this one. So there is this group of people that travel around and sort of gain something like immortality, and are also like, they're almost like traveling vagabonds The old term would have been gypsies, you know.
But they've been around for, they say, like, thousands of
millennia
years.
For some of them, but some of them are obviously not as old as others. And, in fact, we see a new one recruited.
But the big one is Rebecca Ferguson's Rose the Hat.
Rose the Hat? Yeah, she has, she looks like somebody you'd see at a Ren Fair, only, you know, what if that person might murder you? And they are, in their way, very much so, a family, too.
Yep. And this cut, I think, shows that better.
Yeah. It's weird because they can at times seem sympathetic, and yet you see them do something that's just utterly horrible.
Yeah. Well, like when one of them, what do they call it when they, like, skip or something? When the guy started to, the older guy starts to degrade.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're like, he's skipping or whatever.
Right. So, yeah, just, it was like those little, small little instances kind of just
it's
like
cool world
me.
Building.
It is.
And then, so there's three stories going on. There's their story as they hunt down and look for people who have the Shining, and they need to feed on them every once in a while.
What do they call it? Steam.
Steam.
Yeah, steam that's like, it's almost like the essence, the soul of a person that leaves their body when they're dying. And what they like to do is torture people to death and who have the Shining. And that is a particularly potent steam that emerges from the person.
They tell the kid that pain and fear amplifies the steam. Yeah, it's brutal.
Well, like you said, there's that story. There's Danny's story.
Right. As he slowly makes his way into some recovery
and
like halfway house stuff and sobriety, and he's kind of
makes a friend.
Makes a friend. You know what? One of the things I actually always liked about Stephen King is that he was not afraid to sometimes have just decent people in his stories.
Yeah.
There's some people in this, and I look at him, and I'm used to, because of movie tropes, I'm like, oh, what is he up to? He's not up to anything. He's a decent person.
and then there's
a little girl.
The little girl who is, like, the Shining 2.0, super powerful.
Much more powerful than Danny, but also struggling with it, hiding it from her parents.
Yep.
The stuff with her parents is good.
Some of these stories don't intersect for, like, some time. Years and years pass, and you see her when she's quite young, and then you see her when she's, like, I don't know, what, 14, 15, something?
Because that original scene with her, I don't think was in the original cut, about the magician at her birthday party.
Oh, yeah.
And her, like, putting all the spoons on the ceiling. I don't think it was. I don't remember
I'm not quite sure either.
But her ability to, like, use she's like, I can do magic. And it's just really cool. And if I'm not mistaken, that girl who plays Lenore in Fall of House of Usher.
Oh, man.
She's from Dr. Sleep.
Holy shit.
Because I actually was wondering the other day, I was like, what happened to her? And then she turned up as Lenore in Fall of Usher.
That's cool that Flanagan does that.
Yeah.
But
she's great.
She's
a really good young actress.
These stories will intersect because, no surprise, the group of creepy people want to find this girl, which is interesting. They're also afraid of her because she is dangerous.
Yeah.
As to just her raw power, if they try and get into her dreams and stuff, is dangerous
to
them.
Well, they're finding it harder and harder to find people with steam.
Right.
And they've come to the conclusion that they want to keep her alive and sort of, like, feed on her.
Over time. Yeah.
And enter Danny, kind of coming to this, being spurned on by, like,
contact him, not knowing who he is, really.
But he doesn't really kind of want to deal with it. It's not until he's visited by
Halloran
again.
Yep.
I love these
scenes.
They're so good.
They're great. And they're not all in the main movie.
No.
Like, they add a lot. The director's cut, the movie is good. Like,
yeah, the movie's
really
good.
I actually really liked it. But the director's cut is a serious cut above. Like, usually, sometimes you have producer's cut or director's cut, you get some that are bloated.
Yeah.
This is fantastic. It is actually, I would absolutely recommend it.
And by the way, also, Danny, just among other things, is also being occasionally still visited at times in his life by essentially the ghosts of the Overlook Hotel.
Yeah, because he's been touched by them and they can find him.
Yeah, and there's Halloran shows him a neat way to deal with it that has resonance throughout the whole story.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool.
One other thing I want to mention is the, I put recasting in quotation marks of his mother. And Jack Jack Nicholson.
Right.
Was that whole Jack Nicholson scene in the with him at the
least bartender? One was, because I for sure remember it. People didn't like that. They wanted somebody who looked exactly like Jack Nicholson.
Oh, but man, I think Elliot.
What's his
man.
Name? Yeah,
does great.
I would always prefer someone kind of make a role their own and reflect the person that we know. But don't try and recreate them. Don't do the dumb Princess Leia CG from Rogue One.
But I feel like the woman who plays Shelley Duvall...
And they didn't.
The woman who plays the mom...
She really did quite a good job.
She does an amazing rendition of that
character.
Yeah,
when she says... When she's talking to him and she's like, hey, how you doing, Doc? Or whatever. I'm like, God, it sounds like
Shelley
Duvall.
She's got the cadence. She's got that kind of... And Carl Lumley as Scatman Carruthers is great. Mm-hmm. And I feel like... Why am I blinking on... Elliot from E.T.'s name.
Henry Thomas.
He does great as Jack Nicholson, I think.
And you'll revisit some of the scenes, like him talking to the bartender at the Overlook and things like that.
And then, of course, you get the music keys.
Right, they use the musical stings in the style of The Shining, so it feels like a link to it, while at the same time being true to the book.
It's a weird thing, because I like The Shining. I don't love the original Shining. I'm a bigger fan of the book.
Same here. I do. What I have to do is I have to watch the movie as its own thing, and then it's pretty great as its own thing.
But this tying it together, I think, elevates it a little bit for me, because I feel like it's one giant story. Mm-hmm. And
you get a better sense of the stuff that King was good at, which was not only talking about addiction, but also the lore of it.
Yeah.
The deeper stuff about The Shining itself. And as we find out in this, the knot and the other stuff.
It's such a good movie. I honestly think it's it's weird. I enjoy Flanagan's first movie a lot, even though it's kind of like very small.
You mean
In Absentia?
In Absentia?
Yeah.
I think that is one of...
I really liked it.
I do too. It is small scale horror in like the best way.
That's the one that's got like the little tunnel or something.
It's got the tunnel.
Like, husband,
it's very
back.
Creepy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's just some really creepy ideas that are executed so well.
I'd have to say, personally, by the way, I think Haunting of Hill House may be my favorite.
Yeah. And then I think Dr. Sleep is my favorite. I really do.
It's really, really good. I mean, Flanagan can do no wrong. I know. I mean, like, even was it Ouija 2? I like that one quite a bit. Like,
it's good. Like, that one I feel is like a little more jump scary.
It is, but it's fun. He's not above
he
a jump scare.
He does like his jump scare.
He does.
A few
does.
Like, what do you call it? Haunting of Hill House had some of the most intense jump scares I've ever seen.
100%.
Yeah.
But he also likes subtle horror, and sometimes he likes doing no jump scares at all.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we would highly recommend everything Flanagan, but the Dr. Sleep Director's Cut. I'm glad I made a point. That showed my memories. Because I watched the original a few years ago, and everyone was like, did you watch the director's cut? And I'm like, no, what? And this year I finally watched it, and it's great.
So the only thing about it is, you have to buy it.
It's not streaming
it's
anywhere.
It's not streaming anywhere.
Or you can do what we did and steal Nick's login. Because
Nick's true.
You know what? It's part of the job.
It is part of the job. all right. Let's talk about a horror movie I don't think any of us like quite that much, although I think I liked it more than you. No One Will Save You. This is the new movie that came on Hulu.
Yep. It had some buzz.
It stars Caitlin Dever from Justified, who is always good.
She is.
And it is a... To offer some spoilers, it is mostly dialogue-less.
There are, like, two lines of dialogue.
It's, like, presented as... Like, you know... It's probably good to know the deal a little bit going in. This is in the trailer. It's what looks like initially like a home invasion movie, but there's the invaders are aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman is a somewhat mysterious young, 20 something woman living in a kind of a country house, near to a small town, but kind of off secluded in the forest by herself.
And she seems to be isolated from the small town.
Right. There is something that has made her a bit of a recluse. And she seems to get some unnerved and angry looks from the townsfolk.
Mm-hmm.
And
we will find out why. They do explain that.
Yeah.
Right. And they do some... I do think there's some good visual storytelling, even though I have some issues with how it plays out. But, like, we see that she is a crafter. She makes, dresses and stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also got, like, this model of the town in the center of her house that she works on in her spare time. But she, like, sends stuff off to people through mail order things. You kind of quickly catch that she is not a big tech person. I don't think she has a cell phone, even though it's modern times, or a computer in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how she gets the orders, but I guess it's mail. and because you do see her handwrite a letter.
Carrier pigeon. Comes by carrier pigeon. But yeah, it's so that's what I knew.
You know
going
what we
in.
All recommend? First 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah, it opens really strong. It has when the alien home invasion happens.
Yes.
And the one thing I really liked going into this, I thought that this was going to be one of these kind of like things like Signs where you just like you don't see The aliens until late in the thing,
and they're very like gray aliens.
But they
like,
they yeah. put the aliens well, front
let's
and center.
Not say too much about it.
I mean, well, that's in the...
they put the aliens front and center. Like you see an alien in the first like 15 minutes,
yeah. Right? There's a neat sequence where she's kind of waking up. Mm-hmm. She hears some noises outside. You, if you've even seen the trailer or something, might have an idea of what's coming.
Yep.
And she looks out her window, and down in the trash, she just sees movement, like some animal or something, yeah. maybe, like, in the trash. And she's like, damn it, or whatever. Actually, she doesn't say anything. But she kind of, like, has this look like, oh, great. And, you know, she puts on her robe, and she's, like, going to go down and deal with it. But then she, like, walks out, and she's a two-story house. And she kind of looks down the stairs, and there's the front door, and it's open.
Yep.
And it's just like the I think the movie is often at its best in those suspenseful moments that are just pure visual suspense, and especially early on, I think those things were very well executed.
I agree, and I also think as it goes on, they keep doing more and more stuff. Like they reveal a little bit more about the aliens and sort of what they're doing and. She's being pursued, and I thought there were a lot of really good sequences in this, but because it is wordless, there's a lot they can't explain, and you are left to divine a lot of it from context, and I don't think they're as good at doing that as, say, like, A Quiet Place was.
Right.
Right. There's still also a lot of ambiguity about the aliens, too, and that's okay. I'm like, I don't mind ambiguity, but sometimes it felt frustrating, and they actually did feel a little shackled by the dialogue.
Yeah, thing. It does occasionally seem like a problem, not a solution to anything. And well, also,
I think, Nick, did you have the same wonder that I know Randy did, and I think I did too, which is that is she just literally mute? Like, is she unable to speak?
I started thinking that halfway through.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I never had that feeling. I just felt like she was just completely closed off and utterly isolated from the world for various reasons.
I also, there was one thing that I don't like people are when they're dumb in horror movies, and she's mostly not, but there's like, after she survives the first night, spoilers, I'm like, girl, you gotta go. And she tries.
She does try, but she runs into an obstacle or two,
and then seems to give up. And I'm like, okay, well, I was like, okay, well, I guess that makes sense. I guess she kind of, and so she basically, one of these things with this kind of movie is it's got you got to have the isolation. Like, you feel like they can't get away.
Right.
And I mostly felt like she could get away. There are reasons she can't. There's a reason she can't go to the cops, which I thought was well done.
Yeah.
There's a reason she can't just get on a bus out of town.
Yep.
However, later on they show that she has a car. And I'm like, you never thought to use the car? Not once? Not ever?
I think she does. She tries.
Does she?
Yeah. She tries, and then
super too late.
No, like, no, it was the first night. She tries, and the car won't start.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they definitely give reasons as to why she can't.
I felt like the isolation was a little forced.
You know the reason why she can't use the bus?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things where I was like, this is kind of a big thing that should... You know, I kind of wanted to see what's going on in the rest of the town after that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was like, is this a dream sequence? Is this really happening? And it was really happening.
Well, the ending does reveal what's going on in the rest of the town.
I guess so.
My problem was that it was small, and then it went giant, and then it contracted again. And I was like, I kind of lost interest after that.
So I'm glad I watched this.
Yeah,
I actually like this. But I compare it to, say, everything from 10 Cloverfield Lane to A Quiet Place, and it's not better or as good as any of those.
Right.
Which do the same kind of thing better.
It was trying to do something a bit different, and I respect that. And for me, some of the alien invadey stuff got sort of repetitive.
It did.
And I lost its oomph, and that was... This movie is only like an hour and a half, and it still felt a little draggy near the end.
Agreed.
It all looked nice.
I felt like if this had been a Twilight Zone episode, or maybe like a 45-minute movie, then that would have, I think, helped it a lot.
You know, if you did the same thing as, what was that internet seance movie? Which was about like 50 minutes?
Yep. Yeah.
That would have been about... Perfect
yeah, I think you're right. So, the friends I talked about this on my TV podcast, TV Dudes, they both said they go to a lot of movie festivals.
Yeah.
And they said this felt like a festival movie that had been expanded beyond its festival length.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm like,
that.
Yeah, that's fair.
I think would we all say it's like if some of what we said sounded interesting, you might still want to check it out. Even
if nothing else, for Caitlin Dever's performance, like, she's great.
She is.
Right, she has to essentially emote a lot of stuff, and you might think it's like, oh, she's just scared all the time. Yeah, she is scared all the time, but there's sort of some nuances to it, and stuff that's fairly impressive.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That she is actually, her emotive features are working overtime to do a lot of work.
And here, I will say the effects are good. The cinematography is really good. Mm-hmm. The way it's shot, I think, is good.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things in the plus column that I would say, press play.
Yeah. But keep that as expectations modest.
I think that also helps.
Speaking of press play, Nick, you sent us a list of like 8 movies that you've watched in the past few days.
I'm in horror mode. I'm in
horror mode, and I've seen 4 movies. Nick, Dave's in horror movies, he's seen 1.
Well, that's true. One of those, a lot of this is my wife was out of town, and I could just watch whatever the hell I wanted to. Even horror movies that she has no interest in, like, I will say, Pearl.
Yep.
Which is the prequel to X by Ty West.
Yep.
Stars Mia Goth, and
I know I have a lot of friends who love this. I believe Dave and I are both Ty West deniers and haters.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is completely understandable. He is not for everybody. I don't know if I would say that this is better or worse than X. I may have liked it slightly better because I feel like it's not so much as it gives Mia Goth more to chew on.
Please tell me the premise to it.
So it's basically that. The older lady in there.
The old woman.
It's her origin story, basically how her parents were overbearing. It's like during World War II, I think.
Okay,
so they just have Mia Goth play the character that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Okay,
and it's basically about overbearing parents, or overbearing mother. Her dad is kind of confined to a wheelchair and not all there, and about sort of life, and she feels confined, and shit starts to go sideways. She starts killing people because she wants to break free. It's a weird kind of, you're not really supposed to root for her, but you kind of do.
Yeah.
But it's the performance that Mia's got.
Characters tend to be not exactly great people sometimes.
No.
Just thinking even about, what was the other one he did? Well, the one with the hotel.
Oh, The Innkeepers?
Yeah, The Innkeepers.
Yeah.
They were both kind of slightly obnoxious.
Kind of schlubby 20-somethings, people,
yeah, who were just trying to, like, catch some footage before this hotel closed, yeah, of a ghost.
That was my favorite of his, honestly.
I'd possibly say it's my favorite. I liked elements of House of the Devil. I think I was kind of on board it for about a good half the movie.
Yeah. This one, beautiful.
But I have definitely determined that I'm not his. He is not my boy.
I agree.
What I like, I'm not big on his movies that I've seen. I think maybe only seen the one, but I thought his visual style is really
his visual style is very interesting. It captures my brain. The color palette he uses here is a little different. Mia Goth is an interesting actress.
I actually really like Mia Goth.
She's great. I want to watch her in Infinity Pool just because I've heard interesting things about that one.
Yep.
But there is
like Cronenberg's kid or something.
Mm-hmm. It's David Cronenberg.
What would Nick? Is there a movie that I know this Ty West kind of does his own thing, but is there a movie that somewhat compares to as far as like how it plays out?
Not that I can really think of.
What's the closest?
I don't. I really don't know.
Is it like The Thing?
No.
Is it like Halloween?
No.
Let me start naming some other ones. Okay. No. What?
But there is a monologue towards the end of the movie that Mia Goth gives.
Yeah,
as sort of
like
an explanation of her character and her motivations.
Uh-huh.
And it's, I hate to say something is so riveting in kind of a weird slasher movie.
Yeah.
But it is. And she just delivers the hell out of it.
Okay. I'll go watch it on YouTube out of context.
Yeah, I think that.
See what the deal is.
Watch a reaction video.
Because there is, I believe there's one more.
Kids react.
In this trilogy. I think it's like
it's about
Mia Goth's character from X.
Max or something?
Yeah,
like
Maxine.
But it
doesn't
have like
Maxine,
three X's
yeah.
in it
yes.
because of the porn connection.
Yes. But yeah, I liked, didn't love, but there was enough okay. there that I thought was good.
Alright.
Yeah. Alright. Then, let's see, you were, something called Cut?
Cut?
Or maybe I missed that. I thought it said cut. Maybe I misread it.
Maybe it said something director's
maybe
cut.
Maybe it said something director's cut. I don't know. Anyway, what about...
Yeah, that was for Dr. Sleep director's cut.
Okay. What about Christine?
Christine is a movie that I had
Killer Car.
I had not seen this movie in, what, 20 years? Maybe even more than that. So it was essentially me coming and, like, having not seen it.
You know, I saw it, like, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and I hadn't seen it ever. It's a John Carpenter movie.
It is.
And in the 80s, John Carpenter could do no wrong, and yet I never heard anybody talk about it, and I was like, it must suck.
Right. And I think that's kind of where I fell down onto it, too, because no one talks about it. Like, when I did my John Carpenter, I don't know, like 6 months ago, when I was watching all the, like, They Live, and...
You did not include
Did not Christine. Include this. But I was like, okay, I want to watch something random, and I was like, oh, I've wanted to revisit Christine. This is a really good movie.
It is. It does not deserve its lack of reputation. It should have reputation as a good movie.
The actors in it, I don't really know very much, other than the lead kid who
Dude from Back to School.
Back to School. but it's about a kind of...
He actually gets a fair amount to do.
Right, well, it's basically about a nerd who finds a car... And he starts to change. That car starts to possess him because that car is malevolent.
Right.
It's been malevolent ever since it was on the line. It actually killed a person and took an arm of somebody else.
Yep.
The car is beautiful looking.
Yeah, it is shot very
impressively. It's like a 57 Chevy It's a Fury.
Yeah.
There were a couple things that surprised me. The effects in this are really good. Mm-hmm. Like, its ability to, like, re-congeal itself after being
mauled. Right, it gets damaged and it, like, pops out the things. I'm honestly not quite sure how they did it.
I don't either.
You would think CG, but obviously they didn't have CG then. And then it's just like, oh, well, did they just run the camera back and, like, dent it and then just show it in reverse? Maybe that's how they did it, but whatever it's done so well, it kind of looks flawless.
Yeah.
I bet they used a real haunted car.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, there's also a sequence of it on fire, which I thought was a pretty darn...
It's a spectacular end sequence thing.
Yeah, basically that end sequence to the very... Like, the last, like, 30 minutes, I was, like, just focused, lasered on.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Well, you know what's interesting is that it is kind of a character story before then, and it's like people just think, oh, haunted car, scary. But there's actually a fair amount about, like... This kind of, like, bullied and disaffected teenager.
Yep.
His buddy, who's, like, a decent kind of a jock guy.
Well, he was, like, the star quarterback that gets injured and then is kind of laid up and a little bit kind of on the outs with everybody.
Right.
And then it's about the nerd's girlfriend.
Right.
And kind of her coming to the realization that Christine is not a good car. And kind of them teaming up to try to destroy it in a lot of ways.
But, you know, we talked about this, Nick, the other day, off this off-mic stuff, that King seemed to be acutely aware before the term incel ever showed up of incels.
Yeah.
And I think he must have been one of those guys who kind of had, like, a brush with it. Like, you know, like, if you are a lonely, disaffected teen in The Stand, that's one of the... What's the name of the kid in that?
Oh.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. Yeah, yeah. And Bowers and...
Well, nah, I think... I'm talking about, like, nerds gone wrong.
Yeah,
this is a nerdy kid who finds this dark side that at first does make him kind of a cooler dude.
Yeah, he's definitely more self-confident.
Yeah, but then it starts to get toxic.
Toxic.
And
his obsession with the car becomes, like, super toxic.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, obviously the car itself, like, that is its own thing, but, like, just as a thematic, I felt like Stephen King knew that people who are, like, nerdy dudes can become bad people. They're not all innately going to end up nice guys.
Can we talk about the creepy bully? Who looks like John Travolta from Grease times 1,000?
Right, he's, like, scary John, jacked up.
Yeah, he's, like...
Jacked John Travolta.
Like, threatening to kill a teacher with a switchblade.
Yep. The sequence that introduces him, it does a lot of lifting to show, A, that our lead guy is bullied, B, that his friend the jock is a good guy, but even he is kind of scared of this dude, and this guy, there's a sequence in a shop class that's very intense.
Yes.
And even the tough teacher, who I feel like he's like a veteran or something like that. Like it can't maybe
yes.
do that.
Yes,
and he's like he's a tough dude. He's a very tough shop teacher, but even he is kind of like a little nervous yeah. about this guy. And it's actually a really intensely staged sequence.
Yeah, and this group of bullies bully him, destroy his car, and things go wrong from there.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know why this isn't talked about more. Within yeah. Carpenter's oeuvre.
I guess it's not his own, like, an original story. He's best known for not... He doesn't do adaptations. It's his only adaptation that I know, yeah. other than vampires in the 90s.
But I will say, this is also probably one of the best adaptations of King's stories.
Yeah, it's true. If prior, especially if you had gone to looked at stuff, like, kind of before, what do you call it, Misery and other stuff yeah. by what's-his-name? Who's that guy?
Rob Reiner. Rob Reiner, yeah.
Then there'd be what? Like, there'd be Carrie, there'd be this, and what else was good in the 80s? There's not a ton. Like, Children of the Corn was okay.
Salem's Lot's
good, but it's not, like, amazing. It's, yeah. it's remembered for some scenes.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this one should be remembered as one of the really good ones.
Yeah. I loved it. And I watched the 4K restoration of it, and nice. It's gorgeous.
Hmm. Nice, yeah. A surprise is a good one.
Yeah.
Another throwback, you watched Ghost Watch?
So, yeah.
This is a lesser-seen movie.
It's a lesser-seen movie.
Unless you know Dave.
Unless you know Dave,
who... Which I forced everyone I knew to watch it about, like, 15 years ago.
Yes, and it stuck with me. I have been wanting to revisit it. It was on Netflix for a little while, and then it went off. This has been kind of one of those weird ones, hard to find. If you yep. had to have like a region-free disc, I remember right. when you showed it to me.
Right, and there's an interesting story that in some ways adds a little bit to the fascination with it. There's a bit of real-world dark lore because there's an actual death associated with yep. the movie. So this movie ran in like 1992, I think, yep. on like BBC.
BBC One,
and it's a found footage thing, but not in the traditional Blair Witch shaky cam way. It is presented as a TV special using real British broadcasters, yep. and even like the guy from Red Dwarf, Rimmer,
yeah, right? yep.
is on there.
He's
to
kind of like
do crowd work and yep. kind of crack wise as they explore like. As a haunted house with a single mom and her two daughters is, they're like, oh, we're hoping something will happen tonight.
It's like loosely based on the Conjuring, Enfield.
The same thing as The Conjuring 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Like, you might not notice it if you weren't looking for it, but it is. And anyway, so it's got all that going on. And somebody, because it was presented as real in that sort of War of the Worlds way, yeah. original War of the Worlds, somebody who was actually already had some mental issues saw it, thought elements of it were real, and killed themselves.
Right.
And so,
it was never shown again. It's never been shown again on BBC.
Right.
It's gone through a couple of like various places. Had a DVD release. There was a special that kind of went behind the scenes a little while ago, but it's a really good movie.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is Nick, I don't know if it's for everybody because it's kind of, it feels stuffy early on and slow.
It's also 1992. It's dated.
Right.
A little
bit, yeah. But not like dated, dated in the way that it's meant to look like that. It's meant to look like a product of its era.
But, I mean, the way it's structured is that there's a reporter that stays in the house with the family.
Right. There's like a truck outside with like, you know, all their electronics and cameras and stuff like that. And there's even, like, people out in the streets behind, like, sort of cordoned off behind tape and stuff like that who are just interested nearby neighbors who are peeking in occasionally. They've got big lights set up out in the streets.
Yeah.
So it's not like, that doesn't seem super scary.
No, and Red Dwarf Man is, like, kind of asking for, like, stories and random, like, crowd-pleasing things.
Yep.
And then
there's a studio audience.
And then the main guy, which is the main BBC reporter that actually was on the air all the time... is interviewing basically a psychiatrist who has been, like, dealing with the family.
Right. And she's like a sort of believer, and she's like, this is really happening.
Right. And then there's the other guy who is manning the phone bank, or, like, running the phone bank of people calling in with, like, various ghost stories. And
right. Or,
but then it becomes kind of like, I saw something in the footage you showed just now.
Right. Yeah. It sort of starts to build. Yeah, first of all, it's, like, pretty lighthearted. Nothing much is happening in the house. The kid, the actors who are all unknowns, so they feel very real, or real British broadcasters, are
basically unknown to us.
Are, yeah, like... endearing, but there's like they just seem like real people, that's and there's nothing really happening.
That's always my favorite thing about a good horror movie.
It's a slow burn.
It's letting you like get at ease and get comfortable with the family, so you actually care about them a little bit. And there are instances in here where like one of the daughters is like banging on the pipes they find, and then that kind of like has ramifications.
Right, it's
stuff.
A question of like, did she fake this?
Right.
And
right.
then there's also, like, I'll give you an example of like one of the creepy things to me. It opens with a not particularly scary sequence that was like just a recorded footage of the girls trying to sleep in their room at night, and they suddenly hear some loud sounds and some like a few things fly around the room. And it's the kind of thing that seems like it would sort of be easy to be faked.
Right.
Later on, they get a call, though, when they're doing the studio audience portion and the call-in portion, and somebody's like, hey, when y'all were showing that, I thought I saw a dark figure in the curtains, in the shadows of the curtains. And the way the movie was made is that figure is not present when you see it at first, but when they play it back and look again, it is.
Yeah.
And then the people who's like the broadcaster guy, they try and like spot it. And they kind of are a little off in it, which I always felt very real to me. They're like, oh, I kind of think I see it. And they that's the shoulders, like, and there's the face
They even do, like, the light.
It's a light pen, yeah.
Light pen where they like, oh, I can see the drapes. It kind of makes the outline of
And
of
they're
this.
Looking in the right place, but they're still slightly off. And I'm like, I always want to be like, no, it's right there. Don't you see it? And it's very creepy to see, though.
Well, and then there's, like, just things laid throughout the entire film.
The lore starts to build up as you hear more calls. The mom talks a bit more about their experience. The ghost's strange name of Pipes.
Yep.
Because she said it was like the central heating pipes or whatever banging was causing it.
There's cats involved. There's weird.
There's a brief glimpses, if you look for them, of Pipes, the ghost.
Yep.
And you might not even see them until a second viewing. It has elements of that kind of unnerving quality of Haunting of Hill House, where there were ghosts in the background and stuff. Nick, one of my favorite scenes is the scene where the dude from Red Dwarf goes to the playground.
Yeah.
It's a night, you know, they have their like camera that's on like the light on the camera, but otherwise it looks realistically pitch black. And he's talking to some local neighborhood moms, and they just describe a disturbing incident that unfortunately involves a dog.
Yep.
And it is genuinely horrific.
It is. I don't want to spoil anything else about it, because I think it is one you should watch.
Yeah.
It's available to buy on any platform, so you can buy it on Vudu or Amazon.
Yeah.
It's a quick, like, 80 minutes or something?
Yeah, something like that.
It's one of those, I love horror movies that get in and get out. And the ending of this is really, really good.
It builds nicely. It's not one of these that's going to have like a lot of big jump scares, but if you kind of like the eerier side of horror, I think it's a really good watch.
Yeah.
We're running a little long, so I want to real quick talk about Dracula, which Dave's been watching.
Yeah, I'll just, I can go through this pretty quick. Stephen Moffat, who did a lot of Doctor Who stuff.
Also Jekyll.
And Jekyll and Sherlock.
Mm-hmm.
Did a similar format to Sherlock miniseries of Dracula in like 2020, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That was a three episode miniseries. I think each episode was like an hour and a half long or so. So each one is
like
a
three
mini movie.
Movies, yeah.
And it restages the lore of Dracula, taking it from both from like the 1880s to the present. Ultimately, you'll hear all the familiar names like Harker and Dr. Seward and Quincy and stuff like that. All the vampire hunters play a role, but it has that very modern vibe. I'd say it's a somewhat queer friendly vibe, in the opening 5 minutes, the nun is questioning a very pallid and horrific looking Jonathan Harker, who has escaped Castle Dracula, and his like his hair has all fallen out. He has like sores on his face.
Yep.
I don't believe it is a random coincidence that the imagery might look like an AIDS patient.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, she's like, I'm going to have to ask you some questions, and this forms the framework of the whole first episode. Yep. She's like, and I need you to be completely honest. And she's like, first I need to know, did you have sexual congress with Count Dracula?
Yep.
And you're like, okay, this is going to turn some things on its ear. And yet it also, in some ways, has the traditional arrival of him that's Castle Dracula. But the person who really emerges as the moving force of the first episode is the nun he's talking to. She's kind of modern in her style. She talks about her faith sometimes lapsing. She's funny, darkly funny, and sort of cynical. And she is a sort of match for Dracula when it comes to it.
Mm-hmm.
But they what begins is almost a series, sort of a chess match between them. And you will find that her name is Van Helsing, and that she has she is part of a lineage that has a connection to him. That will continue throughout all the episodes. The second episode deals with the voyage of the Demeter, which was recently turned into a movie. But I have to say, this was probably a better version of it, where you had a very fascinating cast of people on there, and Dracula is really, as he emerges in this, is quite horrific. He is like a monster, but a very watchable one.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun to watch him be evil, and yet sometimes you're just like, this guy is just the worst, he's a piece of shit, he needs to die. And I think that's a good balance to find for Dracula. Ultimately, it makes its way to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Lucy, oftentimes the sort of party girl best friend of Mina in the stories, is like a club girl in this, who Dracula takes a special attention to because of her kind of narcissism, makes her kind of fearless, and he's drawn to that.
Yep.
And the whole time it kind of subverts expectations. I sometimes feel like it's a little too clever for itself, but he can stage a scene, and there are some amazing scenes in it. Some sometimes gross scenes. There's a fly that goes behind somebody's eyeball in the first 5 minutes of it. But like really what a lot of the best stuff is the characters talking. One quick example from it that he makes of like why he fears the cross, one of the subversive elements of it. He doesn't believe in God or anything like that. He doesn't think it's because he's the Almighty has some sway on him. He says that when he bites somebody, he gets a little bit of their personality. He'd learn a language if you knew it. He knows their history and stuff like that. And he's like, no, the church has made people terrified of the cross. They fear its power. And he's like, I've drank so many people that now it's ingrained in me. Even though I don't believe, he's like, I have to hide from the cross.
It's a really cool idea.
Mm-hmm. And then he darkly says, of going to New England or going to England, he says he's like, I can't wait to kill some atheists. So there's a lot. There's dark humor in it too.
Yeah.
Now I would go ahead and join the people who said I think it's a little flawed and I'm not 100% happy with it, but it is a good trip, and I. You know, unless you hate Stephen Moffat or whatever, and some Doctor Who people do. But unless you hate him, I'd say it's a worthy journey to see a new take on Dracula that has a lot of interesting elements like that.
I watched this back when it came out and really enjoyed it, but I don't remember all of it. I may need to check it out at some point again.
Yeah, it's a good watch with lots of... There's sort of a surprise around every corner.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll wrap up there. We'll be back next week with more. I'm sure we'll talk about more horror movies. I got a couple on my docket for the week. Maybe the second half of House of Usher, maybe, possibly.
I think we will. I think we will.
And until that time, Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.